Welcome, everybody. It's September 29, 2015, and welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Good to be back. Hope everyone had a good summer. We have a full agenda, so we will start right in. And the first thing we're going to do is summarize.
Do you want to do introductions first? Or?
Well, we all know each other. Is there anything anyone would like to say? I think the committee is fairly familiar with each other.
Okay. So we'll open an organizational
meeting. Okay. So I'm going to open an organizational meeting for the purpose of passing the interim committee rules. And Rick, could you please summarize the rules for us?
Thank you, Chair. And just real brief, a little housekeeping. Attached to your agenda is a one-pager with a slip paper. It's the summary of legislation. This is now available online, and there's instructions. There's the 200-page document that summarizes 2015 legislation that passed, some that didn't pass. And if you would like a hard copy,
I think the vice chair has to read all.
We'll run you
pages.
Off a copy at your request, so you'll want one.
I would like one, please.
Okay. Make note of that for the two. And then second, you do have the interim committee rules in front of you as well. These are the almost identical interim rules from last session. Would you like me to summarize them briefly?
Yes, please.
Okay. This does require that any of the rules may be amended by an affirmative vote with at least one day's notice. A quorum is comprised of the appointed members to the committee. The officer of the committee is the chair, and it's the responsibility of the chair to set the agendas, cause notice of time and place of meeting. Subcommittees may be appointed. Hearing notices, posting must adhere to chamber rules. Number seven, all committee meetings must be open to the public. Number eight, upon any one member's request, you can have a roll call vote. And then a majority of the appointed members is required to both introduce a measure and then to approve recommendations. And then the last one is that measures introduced by the committee by any organization or person other than a member of the committee will be stipulated that it's at the request of. And you'll be doing this as we get later into the year before the 2016 session, potentially introducing measures. And that is it.
Great. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2015.
Thank you. Any questions? Any objections? Seeing none, so passed. Close the organizational meeting. And we're going to open an informational meeting on healthy children, healthy communities. We're going to divide this into, we have several fabulous speakers. It's going to be divided into three different sections. Okay. We're starting with Dr. Kent Thornburg, and I think Ryan Fisher will be introducing him, so you two can come on up. And that will be followed by Dorinda Schubert, Matt Morton, Tony Magliano, and Tom Curler, speaking about a couple of fabulous projects that are actually the enactment of the kind of vision that Dr. Thorburn will lay out for us. And then finally, we will get to hear from both of our department administrators for the two sections, the two departments that this committee oversees. So that's for that particular section. So take it away. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I just want to say very quickly how excited I am for you to hear Dr. Thornburg's testimony today. I was thinking I've probably watched the work of this committee last session as much as all other House committees combined. And when you first hear this topic, you'll think, well, is this a healthcare topic? But in fact, when you really dig in, you'll realize how relevant this is to the work that you do. There's one phrase I just want to get you thinking about right off the bat, which is this idea of toxic stress. Toxic stress being not just having a bad day, it's every day having serious concerns about your well-being, homelessness, your personal safety, your food. And this is one of the key impacts that we're going to be talking about, and this is something that you as a committee have a lot of work that touches on. So I'll let Dr. Thornburg begin, but thank you very much for allowing him to come today.
So, Ryan, I know Dr. Thornburg, and I know he's probably not going to toot his own horn. Can you give us a little bit of his background? Well, he comes with enormous expertise in this area.
Absolutely. And to tell you the truth, I'm not qualified to list all of the things. I just, every time I've heard him speak, which has been a number of times now, I walk away with a new, deeper understanding. And I know that he travels all over the world giving presentations and is very highly respected in this field.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, please. I'm sorry. You're going to have to do that for yourself and let us know what your background is.
Okay. You'll be pleased to know that I was trained in Oregon, and I'm one of the few people in my field who...
Can you say your name for the record,
yes,
too, please?
Yes. Kent L. Thornburg. I'm a professor at the Oregon Health Sciences University. What I want to say today has to do with understanding how chronic disease works. And I want you to know that we have learned so much in the last decade or so about it that what you might have previously thought about it was likely not to be right. And that is true for me, too. That's how much it's changed in the recent period. So I'm just going to quickly show you some data that we've learned and help you understand where the field has moved and what it means for the public health. And so I'm showing you two babies on the screen. These two babies have different sizes, and because of that, they have different destinies. I'm going to explain to you why. Next slide. If you look on the left hand, you'll see the list of the top 10 causes of death in 1900. And you can see about half of those causes of death were infectious disease. Wherever you see a yellow circle, that's an infectious disease. You can see in 2010, which is the next shorter column, the top 10 death rates are decreased by a lot because of the reduction in infectious diseases, but you can see that now most people die of chronic diseases, not infectious diseases. And I just want to point out that the deaths from diabetes is a little bit smaller in that bar than it should be, because most people who get diabetes, 70% to be exact, actually die of cardiovascular disease, so they get listed in another disease category. But I just want to point out that some of the things I'm going to talk to you about include diabetes. Next slide. So this slide shows you that men and women in the United States have been putting on weight. And you can see from 1960, men weighed about 165 and women weighed on the average about 140. And you can see how that weight has changed since 1960. And this ever-increasing had a surge in about the mid-90s, which you can see better in the women than men. And in the mid-90s, we started seeing an increase in chronic disease in our country that we hadn't seen before. Next slide. So there are three reasons that I want to show you. If you look on the left, you can see the bars that go up start in 1989 and show you the percent of our population who were obese. And you can see in 1989, about 14% of the population was obese. And you probably know the data now that shows in 2007 it was 28%. And now the CDC tells us that in Oregon it's about 31% of us are obese. This increase really started going up in the mid-90s. And if you look at the right-hand figure, you'll see the rates of diabetes in the United States, either diabetes as a percentage of the population or the actual numbers of people. So what you'll see is that in 1958, which is where that graph starts, and I'm just looking at it, there's not that many people in the room who remember 1958. I do. And it turns out that in 1958, only 1% of the population had diabetes. And you can also see that that's been creeping upwards, and in the mid-90s, the curve became steeper. This is the same time that obesity rates started going up at a higher rate, and also people with uncontrolled hypertension, which is shown in the lower left. This, unfortunately, is a very expensive proposition for us because, as I've said, people who have diabetes usually acquire cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease to be specific, and they die of heart disease. And because of that, this has been a very expensive disease. Right now, we spend roughly $1 billion a day in the United States on cardiovascular disease. And in 15 years, that's expected to double. And why is it going to double? It's because of that diabetes curve there. That's because the number of people, and particularly children now who are acquiring diabetes, will be coming up the ranks, and as they get older, they will suffer the disease themselves. Next slide. So what I've plotted here for you is to show you a little bit about how that percentage increase has occurred. This is not a linear scale, but now I showed you that from 1958 to 1973, the first two left-hand bars on there, the short ones, took 20 years. And in 20 years, diabetes rates increased by 1%. Now, if you will look in 2012 to 2013, we got another percentage increase in 1 year. And what this shows you is that the rate of increase of diabetes has been increasing ever since the mid-90s. And right today, 1 in 10 people across the country have diabetes. 1 in 4 people over 65 have diabetes. And the CDC projects that by 2050, 1 person in 3 in the United States will be diabetic if that curve that we're watching keeps going up at the same rate that it is now. And my point of being here today is that we can't let that happen and we should do something about it. Next slide. So this shows you that the increase of dementias is going up with diabetes in the United States, and now there's a very clear biological reason why that's true. People who are diabetic suffer more dementia and mental diseases. Next slide. Now, I'm going to start showing you now data that helps us understand why this is happening. All of these dire statistics that I've been showing you are absolutely true, but we've had a mixed view about why they happen. I want to show you data about why people are vulnerable for getting these diseases, and this came from David Barker, published in 1989 for the first time, nobody hardly noticed. And what he showed was that the risk of dying of heart disease in England was dependent on how much you weighed. He was the first guy to show this. And what he showed that if you were weighed at the 5-pound end of the birth weight scale, you have a 3 to 5 times higher risk of dying of heart disease than if you weighed at the 9-pound end of the scale. And it's graded. The more you weigh, the less likely you are to die of heart disease. And we now know that this is true.
You're saying the more you weigh at birth.
Yes, what you weighed at birth. So that's birth weight as a function of risk of dying. The next slide will show you that this is true even more powerfully for diabetes. Came from the same study. And here you can see that birth weight predicts diabetes and that babies that were in the 5-pound range over on the left have an 8 times higher risk of having diabetes than if they were born larger. So what, next slide, what we now know is that this curve goes up again. So now what I'm showing you is the death rate for cardiovascular disease, which has now been replicated in 6 countries, including those 5 you can see up on the right-hand corner. And we now know that all people live on this curve. People who are born at 5 pounds have high risk for dying of chronic diseases. People who are born larger have lower risks. Unless you were born over 9.5 pounds, and then the risk curve goes back up again. And it goes back up because people in that category are usually born to obese mothers or mothers who have poor glucose control and they're diabetic. And this glucose goes across the placenta, causes the baby to lay down fat, and that has the same effect, we don't know why yet, as having very little nutrients during the time you're growing and being born at low birth weight. So low birth weight and really high birth weight are at high risk for having diabetes and heart disease. And by the way, a lot of people in every country live on this curve, and these curves now have been very similar curves for diabetes, obesity, and high blood pressure. So that I just want you to know that chronic diseases now, this is a chronic disease curve that you're looking at. Next slide. So here's a slide that shocked me when I first saw it, and I didn't know, I had suspected that it was true, but now this is a meta-analysis of 4 different studies in different countries. And what it shows is that a person's IQ in childhood is also affected by how much you weighed when you were born. And what it shows is that IQ goes up from the very lowest, this is the very lowest birth weights here are in kilograms. And as your birth weight goes up, the actual IQ that's measured in your childhood goes up as well, up to the 9.5-pound range. So we now know that the way the brain is formed before you're born and especially the other organs in the body, like the cardiovascular system and the pancreas, are configured in such a way based on how much nutrition you get that will determine what kinds of risks you have the rest of your life for having disease. And we call this a vulnerability factor. What it means is that you are vulnerable for diseases if you grew poorly before you were born. Next slide. So what can we say about these two babies? Well, we now know that these two babies that were both sent home from the nursery being completely declared normal by their pediatricians. But we can tell you that they are very different. And you can look at the head size. So I've made a mark on there. So you can see the baby on the right has a smaller head. The baby on the right has a smaller abdomen. And the larger abdomen on the left-hand baby tells you that that baby has a bigger liver. And a bigger liver now predicts that they will be able to control their blood pressure and their cholesterol in a better way. And the line down on the leg shows you how much muscle they have. Babies that are born small and thin have low amounts of muscle. And I don't know if you know your biology about diabetes, but if you have a lot of muscle, you take up the glucose that comes from a meal, and it keeps your glucose constant, so you're less likely to have glucose spikes, which lead to pancreatic burnout and eventually disease. So the baby on the right is protected, is much more vulnerable for having diabetes and heart disease than the baby on the left, even though the pediatricians think they were normal. Next slide. There's a childhood effect to this, and what this slide shows you is that all kids go through an adiposity rebound, which means that first they put on weight a little bit as a child. They lose weight and become thin in their early years of life. And then somewhere between 4 to 8 years old, they start putting on weight to get their normal filled out look that normal kids have. And it turns out that the timing for putting on weight is a powerful factor along with their birth weight in determining whether they're likely to get diabetes or not. So if you look at the highest line on there, means that the adiposity rebound on those kids started when they were 4 years old. They started putting on fat in an abnormal way. And they have high risk for diabetes. If you look at the ones that started when they were 8 years old, they have very low risk for having diabetes, and most of the people in that category don't get diabetes at all, nor do they get heart disease. So there's an early effect that's based on how you grew when you were born. There's a later effect that occurs on how much high-fat foods you eat as a child and how much fat you put on. Next slide. So if you look across the top bar, the average American lives 30,000 days now. And I always tell people you can look up on a calendar to see what day you're on. And it turns out that in that 30,000 days, the first 1,000 days, when you were a pre-implantation embryo, an embryo, a fetus, and an infant, are the days that determine whether you're likely to have chronic disease. And that's the period of time when vulnerability for disease is set. And as you can see, the risk goes down very rapidly as you become older, where nutrition has a long-term effect on your body. Next slide. Now I'm going to tell you about the second hit, and this graph's a little complicated, so let me work you through it. What it shows is the risk of having high blood pressure when you're 60 years old. And if you look at the light bars in the front, next slide, what you'll see is the light bars in the front tell you what happens to people, what their risk for having high blood pressure is if they were born large. So the z-axis, the one that goes toward the back, is birth weight. And across the front, the different categories in there is how much you weighed when you were 60. So these are babies that were born large, and different categories based on how much somebody weighed when they got to be 60. And as you can see, the curve goes up. So people who were at the highest bar in that group are the ones who put on the most weight as adults. And the ones that are in the lowest bar, which is almost zero, are the ones who have hypertension, who were born large but did not put on weight as adults. Now, next slide, please. If you look at the back bar, these are the babies that were born smallest. These babies already started, even if they didn't put on weight as an adult, they already have a significant amount of heart of hypertension. But if they put on weight as adults, then it went up very steeply. And you can see that babies that were born small and became heavy as adults have 60 to 70% of everybody in that category has high blood pressure. So what this tells you is what we call a second hit. When you're born, the birth weight you hold is your first hit in life if you were born small or you were born way too large. That's your first hit. That's the level of vulnerability you have for your life. Doesn't mean you're going to get disease, but that depends on the second hit. And the second hit is what kind of environment you have later in your life, which includes diet and stress as the two main ones. Next one, please. So the next part that you need to understand, I hope I don't am not swallowing you in all this, but I just think this is a fascinating part that we've only learned recently. And this is the intergenerational effect. We call it the 100-year effect. And I'm going to use myself as an example to start with. I'm 70. My mother is in her 90s. She's still alive. She lives in a retirement home in Newburgh.
Thank you.
So I talked to her. That's not me. But it turns out that that picture was taken in 1931. It's from the National Institutes of Health archives, where we can try to follow some people. And what the example of me is that the egg that made me, I just want you to know I came from an egg. I'm trying to get your biology, remember your biology. The egg that made me was made in my mother's ovary. She's now 90. But it was made when she was a fetus in my grandmother's womb. That's when the egg was made that made me. And I was nourished by my grandmother as an egg, by the diet that she had and her life circumstances, including her stress levels. And those changed the way the egg was made and made it either more or less likely that I would have a risk for disease when I grew up and at my current age. So the risks I face now, not only what my birth weight was and what second hit effects I've had in my life, there's also a measurable effect based on a transgenerational nutrition that's important. So now if you look at this mother in the upper right-hand corner, this is an 85-year-old woman. She looked like this 2-year-old girl when she was 2, who is being held by her mother in 1931. The woman in 1931 came from the woman standing next to her. So that 85-year-old woman was nourished by the woman way over in the left, by her diet, when this woman who's holding her was actually being nourished in the womb as a fetus. So that makes sense? Now then, there's a generation before that, because the lady on the left grew in the lady who's at the bottom. By the way, that lady at the bottom doesn't look too happy. I don't know what her problem is. But it turns out that that lady was born before the Civil War. And I just want you to know that that lady up in the upper right corner, who's 85 years old now, can trace her nutritional background all the way back to the Civil War. And we're doing that with data now in the United States, trying to find family lineages where we can trace this nutrition. Next slide. So why is it that the mother's nutrition can affect the egg that made me? And the answer is epigenetics. Have you studied epigenetics at all yet? If you haven't, I'll tell you a bit about it. Epigenetics is the way DNA can be modified by external environment so that the genes you carry can be modified, turned on or off by environmental factors that happen at different times in your life. And the time in your life when you're most susceptible to epigenetic changes is before you're 2 years old. It's that early developmental period where genes are very sensitive to the environment, and particularly the stress and nutrition environment, and they will set then what kinds of risks you're going to have in the rest of your life. Next slide, please. So now, I've told you about intergenerational nutrition, poor maternal diet, mother's body I didn't tell you about, but a mother, when she becomes pregnant, it depends on how much fat and muscle she has on what she can provide her baby. Chronic social stress I've mentioned, and there's a paternal effect, which is minor compared to the maternal effect. Fathers' diets have an epigenetic effect also on their children, so if they're poorly nourished, For a long time, we couldn't measure it, but now we can measure it. There's a male effect that's definite, so both men and women, their nutrition will be passed on to the next generation. And what I'm going to show you is that all these things cause a change in the baby that change its epigenetics and structures and will lead to disease if they get a second hit. Next slide.
Can I ask a...
So we're in a vicious...
Dr. Thorburn,
yes.
As you're talking about that, I just sort of, you know, when we talk about nutrition, we think food, but I also am curious, you know, like if you looked at like effects of alcohol, effects of drug use, and that as a factor, if your slides are going to get to that, but I'd be curious to see how that...
They're not going to get to that. And in the subset of people who are exposed to drugs, licit or illicit, or environmental toxins, those can affect genes also, and many of those we now know. So even though nutrition is the big driver in a population, there's a subset of people who are exposed to these exogenous, we call them molecules, drugs, or toxins from the environment that can affect the way their epigenetic effect will go, and in a always in a detrimental way.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So this is the cycle we're in, and if you don't think of generations as a cycle, you should, because every mother has nutrition, has a baby. If it's a girl, that baby grows up. It goes through a second hit style, if there are any, and that woman has a baby, and it goes around and around. And it turns out that this cycle, right now, we are in the third generation of Oregonians who have had processed food, that have gotten, who now use processed food for the majority of their calories. And most processed foods, but not all, but most have high calories and low nutrition. And because of that, we're a high-calorie society, and we're a low-nutrient society. We're not getting the nutrients to make healthy people, and people are becoming obese because every time you go around that cycle, babies become more and more vulnerable after each generation to the effects of high calories to bring about disease. I have a lot of evidence for that, but I'm not going to give it to you unless you ask. Next. So the first thing you can ask me is, well, are you blaming mothers for all the sickness in our society? And the answer is no. Even though every mother is providing the environment for the baby that she carries, the community is the environment of the mother. And the food environment and the stress environment that every mother is in during the time that she is pregnant is set by the community, not by her doing. Therefore, the solution to trying to break the cycle that I've just described has to be a systemic solution that's community-based, because there is no other way to do it. I gave you this because if you want to look at it on the OHSU website, here is good nutrition for pregnant mothers. I just want you to know that we're working on this, and we make it available for women who are pregnant. Next slide. Here's my conclusions. And if you don't mind, I'm going to sit sideways so I can read them. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I've told you is that low birth weight and maternal toxic stress lead to childhood cognitive decline and adult disease. I did show you the IQ slide, and what I have to tell you is that babies that are born to obese mothers, which are now 40% of all the mothers that come to OHSU, and babies that are born to mothers who have diabetes, which is increasing, and babies that are born to women who don't have access to good nutrition, are going to take a hit on the IQ scale. And those babies are going to be kids in our schools in the next generation. So I want to make sure that the cognitive development point here is well taken, because it's not just whether or not we're going to pay for heart disease when they get to be 70. It's whether or not we also are going to have kids who can learn well and can be happy in our schools. So current trends suggest that the prevalence of chronic diseases and costs will increase over the next 20 years. We all know that. The largest driver of disease vulnerability is poor diet among women of childbearing age. Even compared to stress, poor diets in America right now and in Oregon are the biggest culprit for our problem. And data from the Oregon State University that has done some nice work on this show that the predominant diet of people is devoid of nutrients and is high calorie. And therefore, many people depend on processed foods that carry very few nutrients, but they have high levels of sugar, salt, and fat, which are all harmful in high levels. Now I'm going to skip the next piece. I've already said a lot about social stress, affordable housing, employment, and lack of prevention care for people who are poor is one of the big drivers for the current crisis that we're in. And we want people to know that breastfeeding for people in any economic circumstance is a valuable way to take care of babies during that early time after birth. And lastly, current prediction practices have the prevention practices in Oregon and other states have not had a strategic plan for early life vulnerability. That's never been included. And I just want to say that we will never turn around the curve of increasing diabetes by always trying to treat the people that are at the top of this curve. If we aren't working at the bottom to help young women before they get pregnant and in their pregnancies to have good nutrition and lifestyles, everything we see about the increases in disease will continue. So we support a comprehensive, cross-cutting, all-out attack on current disease epidemic, and we think policy changes are needed, include statewide nutrition education, which the Moore Institute that I work with is going to put as its high priority, and if there's any way the state could work with us, we'd be delighted. Supplemental support of WIC mothers, unaffordable housing, and unemployment as the drivers of the stress and the nutrition pieces that cause disease. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have several questions. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. First of all, I really appreciate this. And, you know, we have about, if I'm trying to pull from memory, about 49,000 live births a year in this state.
That's about right.
A significant portion of those, over 50%, I think, are on the Oregon Health Plan.
That's correct.
So we're talking about live births that are born to mothers who are economically challenged, many of those on our food stamp programs. And I, for the last three terms, have brought forward legislation to do two things around food stamps, which is ask for a waiver to the USDA to require shopping and nutrition education as part of receiving them, but then also to remove the foods of minimal nutritional value out of the food stamp program. And is that consistent with the type of policy that you're recommending?
It is consistent. We would feel badly if it were limited to that.
Well, yes.
Yes. Because
disagree.
The breadth of what we need to do is much larger over, you know, a period of time. But that a step in that direction would be helpful.
Follow up?
Yep.
So the other question I have, well, the other comment or question I have, maybe you have an answer for, if you have a situation where a parent, going back to your picture of the four generations, you know, parents on a good track, parent slips off a track, generationally gets back on track, like what does that look like?
Yeah.
And how, what are the effects if you can reroute somebody's genetic health that way?
Right. That is a really wonderful question. I wish I'd covered it in my talk, but I'm glad you brought it up. So there are two points I'll make. The first one is that there is a study that is a very credible study that shows that if we could nudge the birth weights up in a relatively normal range, say even 7 to 9 pound range, and if we could stop the adiposity rebound on children who are at the 4 and 5 year olds, we would reduce diabetes by 57% in one generation. And the fact that we're moving up the curve, not doing any of this, tells me that some of the strategies we're using are important. I'm not criticizing strategies that are presently in place, but they're not enough. And so the question is, can you get back on the track? And the answer is yes, and we believe you can rejigger your genes. Don't quote me on that, but you can change your genes in one generation by changing nutrition at the key times when you're most vulnerable for having epigenetic changes. And those are early in your life.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Thornburg. I'm particularly interested in racial disparities, and that's probably subject for a whole other presentation.
By the way, if you'd like for me to come and talk on that sometime, I'd be
wonderful.
Delighted.
Wonderful. I think we probably will.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Talk about environmental issues, toxins. I guess I'm I'm frustrated because last session we were unable to pass a bill that would cover all children in Oregon. And clearly, I mean, your presentation really argues for the fact that we really need to cover all children if we're going to stop that second hit. Yeah. And it also really reminds me of how we really need to think about intergenerational poverty in this capital. So anyway, all of those kinds of things, I think, are probably topics for another presentation. But again, thank you for helping to draw our attention to this issue. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. We work with the Black Parent Initiative and several Hispanic groups. And I'm particularly excited about working with Hispanic groups for this reason. They're at a window of time where they can prevent the really massive increases in diabetes that we've seen in the non-Hispanic community. I hope we can do something for them.
Thank you.
He has to leave for a bill signing.
So I'm interested in dialoguing more on this in the future, and I'm interested if you're aware of any sort of community health change efforts, studies that have been done where an entire community has changed their health as a program together. This January, we're launching. A friend of mine who's a physician has written a book, and we're going to launch it in Grants Pass. It's called "It's Our Lifestyle," trying to change the entire community health and working toward that, and doing a study at the same time. And it ties into all of this. We're launching it out of the faith-based community, but of all the different denominations.
Fantastic.
And so I'd be interested if you're aware of any community studies where a whole community has changed their health as a whole that are out there.
Well, there are some studies in Iowa that you probably know because they wanted to become the healthiest state. I don't know if you know about that competition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And there are some communities there mm-hmm. who've done but there's a very short studies, 1 or 2 years, and what they've done is basically picked the low-hanging fruit to help the community right off, which I'm in favor of, which are things to make sure everybody gets preventative care, they get to the hospital, and that they get actual good medical care and preventative care. Here's the problem, though. None of the groups, including all of the nationally famous groups that are trying to change communities' health, do anything for the development of babies and their vulnerability. People, I'm going to say this in a different way. If you're not vulnerable, the second hit will not give you disease. And if you only study people who are older and you're trying to keep them from becoming diabetic by putting on exercising, eating a good diet later in their life, it will help a lot and you can measure it. But the people coming up will still be vulnerable. And unless you can keep this up all the time, you're still going to have the same increase. So we need to have babies that are immune to having all these problems, as we have had in our country before when heart disease was non-existent.
Thank you. I will be back.
Yes. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kennegar. Thank you. That was such an informative presentation that you, and I appreciated the statistics showing about the birth weight and the correlation, and I understand that.
Yeah.
But what I was wondering is there an increase in the number, I assume the answer is yes, but I want to clarify that, is there an increase in the number of children being born in Oregon and the United States that are below this 5-pound weight?
Yes.
I would think that there is.
I didn't show that slide, but you should know that during the time that I've been discussing since the early 90s, the average birth weight has been going down in the United States.
So, follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Kennegar. So I'm 48, and I feel that it's my generation of women and younger, of course, that there just seems to be a lot of babies that are born very small weight and that have been in, I mean, your heart goes out, of course, to the families where you have a child and in these neonatal units, and they have to work with them and keep them. So you're in our efforts to help, and I completely understand where the families are coming from, of why you want, this is your baby, and you want to help your baby when they're born with this low weight.
Yes.
Are you concerned about, this is kind of a loaded question, but it sounds like you're a little bit worried, or maybe you could clarify for all of us about this practice that we have of we have all these babies that are being born of a low weight. Is it pretty much across the board that they're at high risk for the rest of their life?
Yes.
Or is it only because is it certain circumstances you can be born of a low weight, something going on with the mother's health or something other? Or is it really that high of a risk?
Yes, it is.
That's a lot of
all babies born in their weight category carry the risk.
Right.
They have the vulnerability.
Right, but how does it play out?
But it doesn't play out. And what there are very good studies that show that middle class and high income families don't get the second hit that people who are less well off. So you should know that the smallest babies, I'm sure you do know, are born in the African American communities.
Mm-hmm.
They have the smallest babies and the highest risk for disease for the rest of their lives. And babies who are in the non-African American community, non-Hispanic community, small babies there who are in poverty, which is most of rural Oregon, those babies also are at very high risk for having diabetes and heart disease later.
Thank you. That's very concerning.
So I wanted to say a couple things. I know we don't have a lot of time, and it sounds like the rest of the committee would love to have you back, as I always do. I have probably seen 5 or 6 of your presentations, and every single time they're completely different slides. So I know that he has a lot to draw upon. Some of the ones that I've seen in the past that are also really interesting are the stages at which now you can measure, like, nutritional impact, and I think it was the 34th week of kidney development and genes that can get turned on and off that give a proclivity toward diabetes and chronic disease. Another thing that you've stressed in other presentations is the stress level and what happens when, I think it's the cortisol or the adrenal system of the mother, pregnant mother, and how that impacts the development of organs at various stages and how that increases the proclivity toward chronic disease.
Do you mind if I just say one thing?
I would love it if you'd say that, because the rest of the panel that's going to be following you, we are going to talk. I'm sorry, Representative Parrish left right now, but I do want to assure her and all of you that we are going to follow up with some of the food bank and other groups that are going to talk about nutrition in the next. It was a big overload with everything we have on the agenda, and it's a really big issue. And I know that part of trying to find policies in this, and I'm kind of saying this on the record so any of the food groups out there can be prepared for the November, is, you know, to what degree do you do education? We do have some very good outreach programs through OSU and others at the food bank and others are working with to do health education in conjunction with SNAP. And the whole, you know, the whole question of whether we get a waiver and limit the kinds of foods on SNAP, I would agree with Representative Parrish that our public assistance programs like WIC should be of high nutrient value. The challenge is that often if you just limit that, the fruits and vegetables are not accessible or they are so expensive. And that's why I think we need a really comprehensive discussion. And what I love about your presentation is it's not about blaming the mother. And I've heard you talk about, you know, the womb is the environment for the fetus and the way that the community is the environment for the mother.
That's right.
And it's not about you're making bad choices or whatever. It's about making sure we break down the societal barriers that are in place right now that prevent them from being able to have a healthy lifestyle, whether it's access to good food and nutrition or whether it's affordable housing, employment, not having domestic violence, all those things that cause stress. And I know that each of your presentations, you know, I've seen another one that's focused really on the generations and graphs that follow generations and twins that are, you know, that have a similar genetic predisposition and raised into a family. So he has enormous number of presentations. And what I love is linking our social policy to real science, especially as it emerges. So there's just a lot there. And you've really, you know, I guess I want to ask one specific question before we go on. The first 1,000 days is not just about the pregnancy in the first 2 years of life, where we know that there's such a huge return on investment, but there's a period just prior to conception that like folic acid, we know certain things. You were talking about the fat versus muscle mm-hmm. composition. When you talk about the first 1,000 days, is there kind of a critical start before conception? Are we talking about 100 days before conception? Like, where does it, how far back is the most critical time prior to conception?
Well, we don't know the answer to that, but what we do know is that the healthier a woman's body is and the better proportion her body is with regard to muscle and fat.
Mm-hmm.
If you have too much fat compared to muscle, then there's a metabolic abnormality,
mm-hmm.
and that automatically harms the fetus to some degree.
So I have seen in some of your prior presentations how much you can change by changing the diet and other factors during pregnancy, and so that has implications for our policies supporting, like the WIC voucher programs mm-hmm. and others, but also supporting women who are of reproductive age who may become pregnant soon.
Yeah, that's right. So I would tell you this, that we need to start with adolescent girls, and we want to start educating them about this. It needs to be in our schools so that they know how important nutrition is, not only for their children, but their grandchildren. That's the way this works.
Right.
And the other piece I wanted to say about the stress is that when you're under a stress position, that is, if you're late for a meeting, you're at a stop sign, your cortisol goes up. That's a normal reaction to it. And an hour later, when you get to the meeting, it's down again. You're fine. But in people who live under chronic stress, toxic stress conditions, their stress cortisol is up here all the time. Cortisol goes right across the placenta. It inhibits the way the baby grows, and it causes a low birth weight baby. This has been shown very clearly, even in Oregon, based on women who are battered. They have small babies, and that's the reason. So the stress piece of it fits right along with the nutrition piece, because most people who aren't doing well and living in poverty, they have both the stress and the poor nutrition, and that is a double hit for their kids. Yeah.
Right. Well, that sets us really up great for the next panel. So thank you so much, and I'm sure we are going to have you back.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So next for our panel is Dorinda Schubert, Matt Morton, Tony Magliano, and Tom Curler. Is Tom here? Are you going to go on your own first?
They're back.
do all four want to go together?
That's fine. Tom's
not coming? Okay. So these are examples of one project that is actually going now, and another one that is in the works, is in the planning, and is being developed as we speak, that deal with how do we really support families to lower the stress and to raise the healthiest next generation. These are really great examples of the kinds of challenges and vision that he proposed, and you're actually doing it. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us. Good to see you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, and it's nice to be back. Thank you for having me. My name is Dr. Dorinda Schubert, and I am a clinical psychologist, and I have the honor and privilege of serving as the executive director of Bridge Meadows. Bridge Meadows is an intentional intergenerational community designed for families adopting children from foster care and seniors living on a limited income. This affordable housing community is the intersection of housing, healthcare, aging, and child welfare. And education. The crux of the model is that the community serves as the healing agent, supported by the professional staff who provide guidance and education, and intervention is needed. In such a community, permanency, a sense of belonging, and improved health and well-being occurs for all three generations. There's affordable housing, education is provided to families related to what does trauma look like in children so that the families are better prepared to deal with their children, as well as the elders learning what it means to live near and support children who have been traumatized. Also, we partner with Oregon Health Sciences University, where graduate students in the dietitian program come and provide nutritional services and education so that we can address the issues of diabetes. I come before you today to share some of the positive impacts we've seen in the last 4 years. Children who have experienced trauma and then life in the foster care system are finding forever families. 75% of the children who have been served by Bridge Meadows are now adopted, and the rest are on their way. By having these children adopted and no longer languishing in foster care, there's a savings to the child welfare system. The children have demonstrated a reduction in their mental health conditions and are now managing the effects of their trauma with adaptive skills and the compassion, love, and support from their parents and their neighbors. Children with high levels of adverse childhood experiences are now having the trajectory of their lives being positive, healthy direction rather than down the road of significant health problems, as we just learned about in our previous presentation. 85% of the children have experienced improvement in their academic achievement, which is tremendous. They are now attending school regularly. 100% of the kids attend school all the time, except for when they have a bad cold. They're performing at grade level or better yet at their potential. The elders serve as mentors to the children, assisting them with their homework. So not only getting good support at school and attending regularly, but they come home and there are homework tutors to help them out. 97% of the people who live at Bridge Meadows have experienced housing stability. Typically, when families adopt children out of the foster care system, their income changes drastically. As they no longer receive the foster care subsidy, they now receive the adoption subsidy. And at that point, at that critical moment, when children are in that moment of adoption, the families are likely to lose their housing, adding to the stress of the family just coming together. But not at Bridge Meadows. 89% of the adults report feeling stronger as parents, which is really important. Many of the folks who are becoming parents at Bridge Meadows, this is their first time they've ever become parents. Their grandmother, well, not the grandmothers, their grandmothers, their cousins, their aunts, and their great aunts who are taking on the challenge and the love for these children. And the mentors, the elders, are feeling stronger. Initially, the elders were concerned that they would say something wrong to the children and make them worse. And we said that can't possibly happen, so don't worry about that. And so we provided significant education to the elders about what toxic stress and trauma looks like in children and how they can respond in a way that is will produce positive results. Elders have shared anecdotally that their physicians are reporting their blood pressure is decreasing, and those living with serious chronic illnesses such as cancer are living longer and healthier than their cohorts. I need to get those physicians on videotape saying those things. They're living with meaning and purpose. Many cultures in our city, our country, and around the world live in a three-generation family or community. It's just natural. In an intentional intergenerational community such as Bridge Meadows, we leverage the strength of the members to lead to healthy healing and empowerment. In the short time that Bridge Meadows has been open, we've received national attention and recognition. We've been on PBS NewsHour, and this year we were featured in Wall Street Journal. And we've won an Intergenerational Excellence Prize from the Eisner Foundation. I thank you for supporting the development of these communities and request you consider supporting the operations of intergenerational communities, especially as it relates to the savings in child welfare, improvements in academic performance, and savings in healthcare. And I'm going to leave you with a quick story. Little Maria came to us with her two brothers who were very traumatized. They had had multiple moves and were on the verge of being separated. And their cousin said, I will take these children on. She'd never been a mother. She was in her early 30s. And Maria came first because she was the easier one. And Maria was so anxious, she could barely speak or see any of us or talk to any of us. And we weren't quite sure what types of trauma she had experienced that she wasn't verbally able to say because the trauma had happened since birth. Well, I will tell you now that little Maria is a healthy, well-adjusted third grader who was just labeled talented and gifted. I'm so proud of her. And she's a confident cheerleader and a consistent volunteer in the Bridge Meadows community. And you would never know that she had had the traumatic experiences of her early life. So thank you for your time and for the opportunity to share about Bridge Meadows. And I look forward to making more Bridge Meadows in our state as we are now moving, making another community in Beaverton, Oregon. Thank you very much.
That's great. So how many, so half of the units, the affordable housing units, are for active seniors 55 and up, is that right?
Yes, we have 9 family homes for families adopting children from the foster care system and 27 apartments for elders 55 and older who are on a limited income. And in our Bridge Meadows Beaverton community, we will have at least 37 units with 28 units for our elders and 9 for our families.
And so the elders have a reduced income in return for volunteering 10 hours a week. Is that right?
It's 100 hours a quarter. So in order to pull our elders out so that they are living with meaning and purpose, which we know has an incredibly positive impact on their own health and well-being, the elders who live at Bridge Meadows are required to donate 100 hours a quarter with their time and talent and devotion to the community. And that can be whatever gift they want to share. Some are mentors to the children. Others make our library look nice. Some take each other to the grocery store. And it's really about connecting. So sometimes the volunteerism is really just sitting and listening to a child, going to the baseball games with the kids. It's really quite wonderful because when the children are adopted by their grandmothers or grandparents, they lose a grandmother. But in a Bridge Meadows intergenerational community, you gain 20-plus grandparents. So the children really have a great sense of a fabric of a community who cares deeply about them.
So for those who don't know, this has become a huge national model. It's been written about a lot, Ridge Meadows. You can Google it. It's really something to be proud of here in Oregon. And if you are in North Portland and can pay a visit to them, we've had some of the foster kids, I believe, from your foster, from your community, have come and testified here. I know we had the celebration of some of the foster bills at Ridge Meadows. So it's just a great way to support families who, the parents who are adopting, most of whom I think are single parents.
Yes, we have in our 9 family homes, there are 8 single women, mm-hmm. and they range in age from early 30s to 65, mm-hmm. and 1 married couple.
Right. So in terms of reducing stress, increasing mm-hmm. access to good food, the kinds of things that we know are needed, this is a great community response.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. It's wonderful to be here. My name is Matt Morton. I'm from the Squaxin Island Tribe in Western Washington, and I have the privilege of serving as the Executive Director of the Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland, Oregon, also known as NAYA. At a nearly $10 million annual budget, NAYA is one of the largest culturally specific nonprofit social service providers in Oregon, impacting the lives of over 10,000 people annually, representing approximately 380 different unique tribes. We exist really only for one purpose: to enhance the diverse strengths of our youth and families in partnership with the community through cultural identity and education. Our mission and the project that I'm about to share with you has a long and very strong thread connecting the Native community with the science and the work of my friends who have testified before me. Some of you may be familiar with the indigenous concept of 7 generations. The Lakota, for example, believe our current generation sits in the middle, and we are obligated to look back and learn from the past 3 generations, and look forward and consider the well-being of the 3 future generations ahead of us as we make our decisions. As lawmakers, you might be inspired also from the Constitution of the Iroquois. And it reads, and I think this is really well tied in all of your deliberations, in your efforts at lawmaking, in all of your official acts, self-interest must be cast into oblivion. Look and listen for the welfare of the whole people, and have always in view not only the present, but also the coming generations, even those faces are yet beneath the surface of the ground, the unborn of the future nation. The science behind genetic inheritance you've heard today is no different than what our elders have told us for generations, perhaps with fewer PowerPoint slides, but nonetheless, the message is simple. We reap what we sow. Since time immemorial, our Native American community has come together to identify problems, solve those problems, and create positive change in our lives. Portland's Native community, combining its diverse strengths, have united to address a longstanding inequity. 1 in 5 children today, Native American children in Multnomah County, is in the child welfare system, a rate 26 times higher than that of white children. This is a massive, intergenerational, chronic social stress. Removed from the nourishment of our culture, our youth are more likely to age out of foster care, experience homelessness, drop out of high school, fail to obtain a diploma, and experience mental health and wellness issues. That's what we call a significant second hit. But our community is working with public and private partners, and we've devised an intervention, a place to provide Native American foster youth homes, families, and support to break the cycle of child welfare removal in our community. We call it Generations, and it's the beginning of the way things used to be. Generations is an intergenerational community of stable housing for foster children, parents wishing to adopt, and community elders. In partnership with Portland Public Schools, an on-site early learning academy will provide educational opportunities for youth ages 0 to 6. A community center will provide support services for families, for education, for workforce readiness, and a community health clinic. Generations places 40 units of housing the Early Learning Academy and the Longhouse in Portland's southeast Lentz neighborhood at a 3.5-acre site of a former public elementary school. And this site is near transit, shopping, and public parks. The design of Generations is pretty simple. Community members at Generations are not clients. They're families, they're neighbors, and friends who all deserve love, respect, and dignity. Native American youth and their siblings in foster care are connected to adoptive parents in stable, affordable housing. Community elders become adopted grandparents and mentors who can age in place with a renewed sense of purpose, helping with child care, and providing wisdom. Given the opportunity to care for one another, community members come together to become their own first line of intervention. The Early Learning Academy and Longhouse create a center for the community. A community like this, we know now through Bridge Meadows' experience, can improve, reduce poverty, improve health and wellness, and rebuild the cultural fabric of the Native community. To the youth, parents, and elders who live there, Generations is simply and finally home. Generations has been designated as an Oregon Solutions Project, bringing multi-sector organizations together in collaboration. An innovative and inclusive planning process resulted in a declaration of cooperation signed last year by the City of Portland. I'm not going to name all of these partners. I apologize ahead of time. City of Portland, Portland Public Schools, the Oregon Department of Human Services, Oregon Child Development Coalition, Oregon Housing and Community Services, Multnomah County, the Lentz Neighborhood Association, Capital Pacific Bank, Guardian Real Estate Services, Carlton Hart Architecture, LMC Construction, Legacy Health, and Social Venture Partners. As I end my comments, I'd like to share with you one quote from a former NAIA board member and current community elder. Caring for each other, we learn from and respect one another. From generation to generation, our elders cherish our youth, who in turn honor our elders. That was Ruth Jensen, who's Tlingit. And I'll end with that, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name's Tony Magliano. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Portland Public Schools. Carol Smith, our superintendent, sends her regrets. She's out of town on business. With me from staff from Portland Public Schools, we have John Isaacs, our Chief of Communications, and Sarah King, who's the Project Director for the NAIA Generations Project. First, a quick update on PPS. We are the largest school district in the state of Oregon, now serving approximately 49,000 students. After two decades of declining enrollment, we're now one of the faster growing school districts in the state. We're in our eighth year of consecutive growth, and the Portland State University Population Research Center projects over the next 15 years adding another 6,000 students. PPS continues to be one of the most thriving large urban school districts in the country, with over 80% of our families continuing to choose public schools over private schools. PPS is highly diverse, serving 45% of our student population are students of color. Last year's one-time graduation rate rose for the fifth straight year to 70%, the highest rate since 2000. And over its five-year completion rate is at 82%. In 2011, our board of directors adopted our racial equity policy, one of the most aggressive plans in the nation to directly call out and eliminate a persistent historic achievement gap between white students and students of color. And since the adoption of this policy, we've implemented several strategies to improve service to and outcomes for our historically underserved students. And today I'm proud to be here to talk about one of those projects, and that's the NAIA Generations Project. Data shows, like you've heard, that Native students are one of the most underserved groups statewide, and in PPS, In 2013-14, PPS Native students had a four-year graduation of 69% at PPS Comprehensive High Schools compared to the overall 82%, and 47% district-wide compared to 70% overall. While some progress has been made, achievement gaps persist for Native students at all of our PPS identified milestones: high school graduation, disproportionate discipline, and third grade reading, for example. We believe the NAIA Generations Project, with its comprehensive multi-generational wraparound services, will help PPS accelerate gains in achievement for Native students. Once completed, it will provide pre-K educational and wraparound services for approximately 160 Native American families across the school district. Located in Southeast Foster and Portland Lentz neighborhood, the project will also provide badly needed new development for a long underserved area of our city. I just wanted to highlight some slides. Matt alluded to them. The early learning component of the generations consists of a new 33,000 33,000 square foot regional early learning academy and longhouse. You can see the longhouse in the center running vertical, and the early learning center occupies the right half of the PowerPoint. The left half is the intergenerational housing along with the along the bottom as well, and a lot of street improvements to the neighborhood as well. It's the NAIA Generations is part of the state's and PPS's commitment to increasing pre-K services to historically underserved students, which we now know is essential to improving educational success for all students. Last year, we opened our first of what will become four early learning centers at the former Clarendon School in North Portland. In just its second year, it's now serving over 150 students. In 2 years, we will open our second early learning hub at the brand new Fabian Pre-K 8 in partnership with Concordia University School of Education, which will be co-located with the school. The third will be NAIA Generations. Along with Head Start programs, the program represents a dramatic increase in the number of students PPS serves through pre-K programs. In addition to early education, the project will support children and their families with services such as affordable health care, parenting classes, job assistance, and to date, we've committed about $1 million toward this project. We believe the PPS NAIA Generations and Oregon Solutions Declaration of Cooperation will become a shining example of how public, nonprofit, and private sector partners come together to coordinate services for a population that have been underserved for over a century. Our challenge is to identify capital funding needed to bring the pre-K online and to open to serve our community by 2018. Our urgency is high. We know every year that goes by represents another year Native children will not have access to the services this program will provide. In the next year, we'll be asking multiple other government agencies at the state, regional, county, and local level to help NAIA and PPS bring this innovative and historic partnership to reality. Thank you.
So I just want to say that I know that Dorenda's example of Bridge Meadows was used as the basis of the NAIA Generations Project. So the whole idea of intergenerations, giving purpose and meaning to seniors who can also provide a really valuable role to young families who are struggling, particularly with foster kids. So I know that you all built upon that model and added the early learning, the health clinic, the wraparound services from DHS. Is there a nutritional component as well, community gardens or anything like that?
Yes, you go over.
Yeah, it would be an extension of the work that we're doing at the NAIA Family Center currently. We have on-site WIC at NAIA. We have a project in partnership with Multnomah County currently called Future Generations Collaborative, which gets to the issues that were talked about earlier. Birth weights of children being born are too low for the Native community in our population, and nutrition for pre-pregnant and pregnant mothers is key. So we're working very closely with our partners in the community and our local jurisdictions to do that kind of work.
Great. Any questions from the committee?
I'll just make a comment. I think that I have to admit that my first professional job was actually as a family counselor for CISCO, which stood for Chicano Indian Studies Center of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And basically my job was with the Portland School District as a family counselor, working with Latino families and Native families. And that was a long time ago. So it's just heartening to really see the progress in this facility. What it made me also think about and appreciate was Self-Enhancement Incorporated in Portland as well. I mean, it'd be great if this committee could do a tour, maybe visit these facilities up there.
Yep. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the time.
And that is a good segue into, again, this is a great partnership that you're doing, run by nonprofits in conjunction with a lot of nonprofits in the community and our school districts, but also with the two departments that our committee works with, Department of Human Services and Housing, and they've both played a big role in the formation of these projects. So with that, I would love to invite up Margaret Van Vliet. I don't know, I'm not sure if you're coming, you're probably coming separately from Jerry. But if you can
share or not.
So what we're hoping from you is an update. I want to first thank you, and if you'd like to say anything to tie it into the kinds of projects that you're supporting, like the ones we just saw, because I know that you were heavily involved in the NEA Generations Project, and I don't know to what extent you may have been involved in Bridge Meadows, but I know that you are attempting to really look at the development of affordable housing in conjunction with other services, and that was the reason that you gave your name, Housing Stability Council,
correct,
to the new, it's not just the housing, the roof over the head, it's how do we really keep people stable, recognizing that affordable housing is a part of that. So anything you'd like to say to transition it from the panel we just heard, and then I think a lot of what we want to hear is where we left off was hearing about the reorganization, love to hear how that's going, and then hearing about how are we trying to get the money out the door that you have been collecting, and then the new money that was coming to you, and you are starting to formulate what are the kind of priorities and how you would spend that money so I am hoping that some of these ideas are some of the ideas that you're talking about too, about how do you prioritize projects that are near transportation, that provide services that you're looking at it holistically.
Right. Very good. Well, thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Good to be here with you today, and it's certainly a very compelling topic, and we're pleased to contribute in whatever way we can. I think you're familiar with my agency, but just as a brief refresher in this context, we really see our mission as more than housing. Certainly, providing stable and affordable housing is at the core of it, but we think it's also our job to engage leaders to develop this integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and provides opportunity for all Oregonians. And we've charted out a vision for ourselves that, again, is beyond simply the provision of housing, but that really gets to allowing people to live free from poverty and pursue opportunity. So that's sort of the core of who we are. You've heard me talk about that before. In terms of the way we think about our role within state government, we think it's really two-pronged, that we can position Oregon to achieve economic security for people by strengthening the housing system and doing that integrating work. But we also want to be able to serve greater numbers of low-income Oregonians more effectively within the housing system, and that those are two sort of self-reinforcing goals. We've talked about this in the past. I think it's very relevant today, this idea that housing is foundational to these other social goods, be they health outcomes, safety outcomes, education, and so forth, that we are taking very seriously this idea that we need to align our work across agencies. We're working hard on that. It's challenging work, but I think we're committed across agency leadership to really drive that very hard. I do want to make a reference to our investments in the projects that you've heard about. We're very pleased that a couple of years ago now, we were able to award funding to the NEA Generations Project in Southeast Portland that you just heard about. We awarded tax credits that will bring close to $9 million in equity when the construction's ready to start, and some other resources as well. So NEA Generations had to compete through the process that I've described to you in the past. Every year we get three applications for every one that we can fund. And so we have tried very hard to position our scoring criteria around these issues where we're doing more than simply housing people, and that there is opportunities to create impact for vulnerable Oregonians and to align our work with other state systems. And this is a great example. While I don't have a slide on it, we have also funded Bridge Meadows in the past. In 2009, we awarded tax credits for the North Portland project. And in 2015, so just earlier this year, we did award tax credits for their new Beaverton project. So again, we're trying to, it's not a perfect system, and we're still saying no to some projects that I think would be very worthy, but we're pleased to be able to position our system in a way that awards these competitive resources to these important projects. I'll talk for a minute about the new money that came to the agency. In total, you'll recall that the agency received $62 million in new money for housing. 40 is this LIFT program, which stands for Local Innovation and Fast Track Housing Program. This is the funds that are funded by general obligation bonds and is specifically targeted for families.
Margaret?
Yep. Can I hold you right there?
Yes.
And stand at ease for the next 5 minutes?
Yes.
The governor's office is a little ahead of schedule. There is a bill signing on the CARE Act, and any of you who would like to be a part of that, that was the act that was giving instructions on discharge from hospitals for lay caregivers to help particularly seniors to go home. And so, I'm sorry, I meant to announce that at the very beginning of the meeting, and it turns out that it's a little sooner. They're ahead of schedule. Okay. So we're going to stand at ease for 5 minutes.
Sure.
I could hand it off. Okay, I reopen the committee hearing on housing and community services. On human services and housing. Margaret Van Fleet.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, the update is on the LIFT housing program, the $40 million, which is will be funded out of general obligation bonds. So that's a different source of money than has been invested in affordable housing in the past. So I'll give you a little bit of a process update. We heard really clearly from this committee and others kind of what the overall intent should be for this magnitude of an investment. And so these are the high level sort of legislative intent that we're using to shape the program design. Clearly, we want to serve families at or below 60% of the area median income. And we want to create as many new housing opportunities as possible, but recognize that the sort of the lower you drive the rents, the lower sort of production goals you can get. And so we have a process in place that will help us try and balance those kind of competing priorities. We'll bring that back for some more reaction in February and at other points along the way before we finalize the program. We heard loud and clear that we want to encourage local innovation, and that includes driving down costs and moving as quickly and simply as possible, because housing development can take many years and can be a pretty complicated and costly process. So we heard clearly from this committee and others that that was a priority, and that we also need to achieve geographic equity when we spend these new resources. So those are kind of bedrock for us We're working really hard on driving towards that. The governor has also given her priorities to me and the agency as we kind of take these next steps. And so I'm happy to share with you that the kind of the number one priority is to really drive this alignment with our colleagues, particularly at DHS, to the greatest extent possible, and prioritize families who are in the child welfare system or the self-sufficiency system as a specific target. Now, that may not mean that every apartment in a 10 or a 20 unit building would be available to these families, but it would mean that we'd say if we were going to stand up 20 new units in Prineville, for example, that we would try and make 5 or 10 of them or some number available, you know, working with the field office, working with Director Weybrandt's team to try and to really focus and get the right families access to that housing, because we know that the lack of affordable housing is a big barrier for the families they're trying to serve. So the second big priority that the governor has asked us to work on really speaks to this question of disparities that you have heard about in the last panel, this idea that communities of color face disparities in homelessness, in poverty, in housing instability, and by every metric we look at, non-whites have worse housing conditions, and the current system does not seem to be addressing those. And so she's asked us to place a special emphasis there. You know, we'll surround ourselves with some good partners and good expertise to think about, well, how would we actually execute on that? What different things would we put in place to go after that? But that's a priority focus for us. And then the third area is to really think about focusing on small rural communities that have not yet recovered from the recession, and where the private sector housing market is not going to come and build units for some time. We can see that there is construction starting in some larger markets, but it's not going to happen in smaller communities for some time. And so the way we sort of divide the money or think about how do we meet, you know, two of those three priorities in a single project, what is exactly the way we would propose to meet these, we're working on, and we'll come back in November and February and share more of our thinking and get some more reaction from you all about that.
Before you switch slides, I think we had a question from Representative Parrish.
I do. There's a couple things that you said, and I'd just like some clarity around them. So if you, the last slide had geographic equity, I think, was how it was listed. In terms of how do you, you know, organize that, obviously, on a per capita basis or whatever, and you would get a half a unit somewhere compared to Multnomah County is not a good measurement. So I'm curious how that geographic equity piece is going to be solved. But tied to that, and then I've got something that's not tied to that, that you've said, 20 units, you know, if you stand up 20 units in Prineville, how do we make sure that 20 units in Prineville don't also stand out that that's where poor people live, and that's sort of a segmented, not mixed in with the community very well, because when you start getting into rural communities and you see large-scale units like that across the country, you sort of get what they are, and they're not necessarily mainstream housing and integrated very well. So I'm curious about that. Okay. Those two things, I think, go together, and then I'll follow back up with one other thing you had that I'd like some clarity on.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Parrish, I think the geographic equity, what we're going to do is work with, we've got a couple of different advisory committees, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. But the place we're starting with them is to look at what are the most helpful data points that could point us in the right direction, right? We know that there's need for affordable housing everywhere in the state. So what besides just blanket need should we be studying? Should we be studying the trend in rental rates? Should we be studying vacancies? Should we be studying housing condition, numbers of people in poverty? Where do we see housing cost burdens, and might we match that up with TANF caseloads, for example? So I think what we'll do is try and sort of look at the map and say, well, what are the most dire, you know, indicators of need, and what criteria might we use to prioritize communities to achieve meeting the communities of color and the rural communities kind of aspects of this opportunity. So I think more to come there.
The second quick question, because I didn't want to lose it before you go too further, is you said on the other slide, the one you forwarded to, governor's priority, communities of color, and I think you phrased it as non-whites have greater like housing disparity. I don't disagree, but I'm curious how you measure that.
So, Chair Kinney-Guyer and Representative Parrish, I think on the communities of color, we use census data that can be broken down to look at relative cost burden, like what's the incidence of communities of color experiencing a cost burden or a severe rent burden for their housing. So that data is published and updated by the Census Bureau and the American Community Survey, as an example.
Is that income related? In your mind, what drives that?
Yes,
that's what I'm,
yes. So then
I'm just curious.
You can also slice it by income levels and other housing indicators. So there are data points. The other thing is we do a homeless count every year, or we don't do it. Our community partners do it. We collect the data, and in that process, we do it's a literal sort of street count of how many people are outside or in shelters or the point in time homeless count. And so we collect demographic data in that process as well. And so it's those measures where you can see if the African American population is X, but they're disproportionately represented in the homeless population or disproportionately represented in the numbers of people who are experiencing an extreme rent burden. So there is data available, and we're having some sort of expert and stakeholder committees slice and dice that with us. So there'll be some data points we can bring back to you shortly, I would say.
With any analysis around the why behind it, data is great. You can throw it up on a spreadsheet or something, but I'm just curious if there's analysis that goes with that as to why. And that
would be something. Let me bring you back to that. And then the final point I think I wanted to speak to, and this is certainly one I heard a lot about in session, is this idea that we don't want to create sort of new ghettos. We don't want to concentrate poverty and have there be the stigma attached to that. I can tell you that since the 70s, my agency has been financing multifamily affordable housing. And we've learned over the years kind of to what degree do we need to care about design standards and things fitting into the neighborhood. I would say that today it's pretty hard to tell in a newly constructed project. They very much blend in with the surrounding neighborhood. And that's a point of not just something we care about, but it's certainly something our nonprofit and for-profit housing developers care about. So we need to pay attention to those dynamics, but I don't think anybody's interested in creating sort of the next generation of concentrations of poverty.
Thanks, I appreciate
that. Can I ask a question related to that? Of course, inclusionary zoning is one way to get at that. I can't help but I have to say that in that conversation. But for what you're in charge of, are you able to use any of your funds as your portion of a greater mixed income housing project?
Yes, Chair Kinney-Guyer, yes, we could. And we could, in fact, do that with these funds. And we need to be savvy about how we would count what we were producing here. But I think this idea of mixing of incomes is one
really
that we can very much leverage going forward. And it depends on the community. In some communities, we know that 8 or 10 or 12 units would make a huge difference, and that's plenty.
Right.
Or maybe it's not plenty, but it's enough. But then there's other places where 20 or 30 or even 50 is the right number. And so I think, we need to have a system that's flexible enough. And so I think that's going to be the trick. How do we leverage what the private sector can do for us?
I mean, exactly. In certain areas that are really fast growing, like Bend, mm-hmm. where you have a lack of housing for a variety of income levels,
right.
Our public funding through you in a blended environment where there's other private funding for
correct
higher income right. could be a really exciting partnership.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to add on the distribution, because Representative Bueller is not here, I feel compelled to represent my committee. And as you're talking about different things that you would look at in terms of need across the state, the governor's priority towards small rural and others, I know you probably don't need a lot of reminder to just say in the mix somehow, looking at where the reporting fees come from and taking that into account.
Yep.
Along with shovel ready and all the other kinds of things that we've discussed.
Thank you.
I've done my duty.
Okay.
Please note and report back to your...
So I don't need to spend a lot of time on this slide, but just to make the point for you that we very much intend to link arms with our colleagues at DHS in these systems. I think there's also some very promising work coming out of the early learning hubs, not everywhere. So we don't want to lean too heavily on that, but I think that there is something to be gained from leveraging the work that communities are doing in that regard. To the extent we can sort of prioritize these families, as I say, that DHS is working with, and use, again, data. We might also use date, but this should say we'll use data to inform our investment priorities to the very best of our ability. In terms of oversight, I want to make a point here. The Housing Stability Council, which actually goes into effect in January, will add to the existing state housing council, and will the existing council will just sort of continue on and add a couple of members after the first of the year. So they're the primary advisory body for the agency, and they will provide sort of ongoing oversight of kind of the program design and implementation for me and my staff. They have formed these two subcommittees to kind of augment their expertise. One is focusing on policy, and it has kind of the best minds in social services, has good representation from DHS, from Department of Ed, but also nonprofits and housing authorities across the state. They're helping us think about some of these policy connections. And then there's also a financial structuring subcommittee. I think of these as kind of the real estate experts that understand how deals get structured, what's feasible. They'll help us think about those pieces, and including the piece where the state has to take an ownership role. How can we do that in a way that, again, leverages the private sector, doesn't presume to replace the private sector in us taking on this new role? So I'm very excited. These committees have each met once. I've got them on a pretty ambitious work plan through the fall, prepared to bring some recommendations to the Housing Council and then eventually to this body in February for a good check-in before we take next steps.
That's great.
And then the final thing is just to pick up on this Housing Stability Council. This was our biggest piece of legislation that, with your support, we passed. You passed. We are implementing. This is the 2442 that helps consolidate the advisory bodies and clean up some of the sort of chaotic nature of we were getting advice from diffuse bodies. So this is a huge step forward for us. They're already, even though the bill does not go into effect until January, I would say to you that the seven members who currently serve on the Housing Council are very much taking their charge to heart and looking holistically at housing systems, and really sort of upping the level of question they're asking to help guide the agency's operations going forward. I think it's very positive, and we'll look forward to having the governor appoint two new members shortly. So that is those were my prepared slides. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or I'd be happy to wait till after you speak with Director Weybrand. Or hear from.
Questions? Yes.
It's not a question, just a comment. I've seen Margaret at many an event, and it seems in the last month. So it is just a thank you for a great job, because these events are promoting housing and getting housing and throughout our state. So it's just always good to see you.
Thank you, Representative.
I have a question. So one of the things that came up when they were looking into the recording fee was that there was some money that wasn't going out the door as quickly as it might have, but you had your eye on the reorganization and a variety of other things. How is that going? Can you give us a general...
Yes, I can absolutely update you, Chair Kenny Geyer. So what we had... told the committee is that we would have some structured offerings, and we would put those sort of on the street, if you will, in a couple of different ways. There was one that was focused for on housing for veterans, and another one that was a more general sort of distribution of the document recording fee. That offering was out. It has closed. We received 30 applications in total for those two, the veterans and the sort of general housing. We're in the process of scoring those. We're already well oversubscribed. So we know to look at geographic distribution as we kind of make those awards this fall. The Housing Council will take formal action on those awards in December of this year. Okay. So we're well on our way to having that sort of bubble in the funding corrected.
And how many millions of dollars will you be releasing?
We will be awarding, I believe it's 22 in total. It's 25 with the vets and the others, 25. Yep.
So, great. Yeah. Look forward to hearing who ends up getting those. Okay. No other questions?
Do you
have a slide?
I do.
Thank you. Thank you, Margaret.
Members of the committee, my name is Jerry Weybrand. I'm the acting director for the Department of Human Services. I just want to let you know that I was 5.5 pounds at birth. I was born in rural Oregon, and I'll be calling my mom tonight.
And your wedgie? And your grandma.
So when I was in consultation about this particular acting position, I had a mentor talking with me, and she shared two pieces of wisdom that I wanted to share with the committee. The first was, she called the first rule of holes, which was, when you're in one, stop digging. And the second one is, if you lose the power to laugh, you lose the power to think. My staff, many of them who are here, tell me that I give them plenty to laugh about. And of course, now that I say it out loud, I'm thinking that may not be such a good thing. So I have 30 years of experience working in the state of Oregon. I have some other years of experience in the state of Washington, which, if you won't be insulted, I'll tell you is a great place to be from. My goal was always to return back to Oregon, where I was born and raised. And one of my sayings is that I'm here to make a difference, changing lives, and that's what DHS's mission is all about. I find it a privilege to work for DHS. It's an amazing mission. I work with amazing people. Sometimes the task is daunting when I look at the breadth of programs, the 1 million folks that we try to provide services to, and the complications that come anytime you're moving across a vulnerable population. I'm actually kind of looking forward to talking to some of you I've met with. I'm looking forward to meeting with you and hearing about your visions, your ideas, the challenges you've faced, the ideas you have about improving our service delivery system. I have a PowerPoint. I'm not great at technology. I'm guaranteeing you somehow I'll mess this up. But let me try here. I've actually... All right.
The left.
All right. So I've asked, this is the... this is what's new and what's not in DHS. And so I've actually asked Trina Lee, if you'll stand up, the new director for VR. Some of you may recognize her. I've asked Sandy Dugan, the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency, to be here. Some of you may have met Dr. Richardson, the Self-Sufficiency Director, who's new to the service. And Lois, out of pure loyalty, is here. Lois Day, the Director of Child Welfare, is here in case there's questions that you have that she can assist you with. So I also just want to let you know that the long-term Chief Operations Officer, Jim Sertinger, is actually telling me he's retiring. For some of you that know Jim, you'll know this is actually his second time at attempting to retire. So we have some thoughts that he will somehow cycle back and say, I want to once again work for the state, despite my telling you that I want to be gone. See, I told you.
Here, do you want me to help?
That'd be great. One slide forward. Okay. So some of you have seen this slide. This is really about our mission, our core values. In a complex organization, when we're faced with multitudes of decisions and sometimes there's not a policy or practice to guide us, the thing that I like to tell the folks I work with is that that's when we need to have our values light our feet, to try to make the decisions that are right for Oregon and right for the taxpayers of Oregon and right for the legislature, which is our board of directors. You know these, you've heard them: integrity, stewardship, responsibility, respect, professionalism, innovation, and a commitment to service equity. We recently did an interesting exercise through the Department of Administrative Services where they asked us to poll our managers on 45 values that they were looking at statewide. So we went ahead and did this across our program managers and our district managers, and we also did a survey of all of our managers out in the field. And we then brought all the program managers together and compared. And it was fascinating to me that out of 45 values, there was agreement of the 10 we wanted them to focus on, 8 of the 10 were exactly the same across all those folks we polled, which is a statement about putting that vision and mission in front of folks and why they come to work for us. So this slide might be familiar to you. This is the slide that's talking about where we've been and where we're wanting to go. One of the conversations that I've had with the governor was that we are at a time that we need to continue moving forward with the agenda that you've so thoughtfully laid out in front of us. The level of investment has been very high in us, and that this is the time for us to capitalize on that. You can see that we've talked about moving away from program and policy, more to a customer-based focus. I'm picking some of these here, trying to make sure I stay within 10 minutes. Crisis-driven, reactive, we want to be anticipatory, proactive, innovative. It is an interesting conversation as we do this type of discussion with our staff and with our managers as we look at saying that we really want to be thinking differently. And there's a term that some of you have heard me use, which is we have some legacy managers and legacy folks that we're working very hard with some training around how to improve the way they think about the work, how they understand as we try to push the work down within the guardrails so we can be more responsive not only to our public but also to the taxpayers and the stewards. I had a note on here. I just wanted to say we're on the road, but it's clear to me that we've still got a ways to go in terms of moving towards that. So we're about safety for children. We believe that every child deserves to grow up in a safe and loving family. And there's several things that we see as positives that are rolling forward. Some of you have talked with us about different response and is expanding across the state and rolling out. We have a thing we call SPURF, which is Saving, Preserving, and Reunifying Families, contracts that are locally driven contracts to try to provide essential services to keeping kids safe. And many of those contracts really driven by community needs-based assessments to try to fill holes so that they're not a one-size-fits-all across the state, but driven by local needs. We're really focusing lately, especially on the child welfare side, around an increase in QA and QC. As we look at where our cases are and we look at reserves and we look at how our staff are doing, we really want to invest in how we're reviewing that, because if we don't know where you're going, all roads can lead there. We also, of course, are very excited about the $40 million, the initiative across housing. We know what stable families mean for children, and we know what stability means for in future generations, and very excited about what that's going to mean as we roll forward with that. We have had some challenges. We're looking at our safety in foster care as one of the issues. As we look at our abuse rates, they're actually above the national standard. The director, Lois Day, has actually convened a bunch of work around that. We've been working with some of you across the table about how do we look at this and what can we learn about how we can improve safety in the homes. We recently had an interesting case involving one of our licensors through licensing give us this day where in reviewing that information, I've asked for a review of that and an audit on both the licensing side and on the OWAPI side. Not so much, one, because anytime we have a situation like that, there's something we can learn, and we need to do that. And also, I want to be responsive to some of the concerns that have been brought forward, and we want to know, audit-wise, what we learned, if there's systemic issues we need to address. We're about safety for adults. We believe every adult in Oregon deserves to live in safety, free from abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. There are some things that you all know about that we're moving forward to and we're going to continue, and that includes an improved Adult Protective Service data system so folks can be tracked outside of the county where the incidents occurred. An expanded mandatory reporting and rule training across the state, and some awareness. We've got an annual report and financial exploitation study that's coming out that we'll be happy to provide to you. We're about living as independently as possible. We think Oregonians have a right to live independently with dignity, choice, and self-determination. We've got some work going on in human community basis services. It's all about integration of the community. We've got transition age, youth to college and work services that are moving forward. We've also had policy decisions you all supported around the K-Plan implementation on the APS side, and expanded services to adults, including getting services in their own homes. It also expanded services and actually moved eligibility caps to the DD population. There's some risk to that financially that we're going to need to work out, but the policy decision is clear that you want us serving these folks in their homes with effective services. We're about improving employment outcomes. We think every Oregonian can work to the best of their ability and contribute to their families and their communities. There's a collective history of individuals, especially around the IDD community, where there's been some negative stereotypes and low expectations. We've had both the Department of Labor lawsuit that was settled and also the governor's executive order around what we're doing and around expanding those opportunities and making sure that we provide those folks with every opportunity to be successful in our communities. There's a investment that you've made in TANF redesign, and I just let me plug this a little bit. So we're averaging well over 1,300 placements out of the TANF program per month. When you put it in the context of 27,000 families, I believe it's a little bit lower than that right now, that shows you the impact that we're having. Some of that's related to a decision you made a couple of bienniums ago where we converted eligibility workers to case managers to enhance home visiting and work with those families. And it's also, of course, connected to an improved economy, but we're pretty excited about what this means for Oregon's families. It also is, of course, very helpful that on that TANF redesign, that those families that are initially entering into those low-income jobs are not facing that financial cliff that says, it actually is more difficult for me to try to earn a living and meet all my bills than to be on the TANF program. We've also just want to mention, and I think Representative Parrish mentioned this a little bit, that we actually do have a SNAP contract around nutrition that we actually have through the Oregon or HSU to assist families related to the earlier slides that we were shown. We're about improving service and getting results. Oregonians have the right to be served by an effective and efficient government focused on their needs. I just want to mention that in the Great Recession, 2009, we had an 80% increase in the SNAP load with actually basically a decrease in the number of workers to provide that service. Many states were overwhelmed by that, and their application delivery of services went out to almost 6 months. For their SNAP program. Because of a series of lean processes that we did both the intake model and ongoing paperwork model, we actually shrunk our wait times from approximately 2 weeks to the bulk of services going out within 2 days and seeing everyone within 2 days. That's how we were able to make that investment of eligibility workers into case managers to impact the TANF program. We're committed to metrics. If you ask, we can certainly show you online where we post all of our data. We do quarterly business reviews. We're actually hitting the refresh button on that to make sure that those measurements actually apply to what we're trying to measure in terms of the return on investment you make into us as a program. And of course, we're very strongly committed to the issue of service equity. One of the bumper stickers I like to share with staff, just to kind of when we talk about where I am with things, and I actually had someone look these two terms up to make sure that they actually were words, and one of my favorite one is more informational, less intuitional. It's not always an easy conversation with social workers. They're really very much relationship-based, and many of them have what I call the math virus. So as we talk about data and talk about percentages and outcomes, they have a double dose of, wait a minute, I mean, I don't want to move away from making a difference, and we have to bring them back to go to that other statement you heard earlier, which is when you don't know where you're going, all roads lead there, and we need to be able to deliver to you the services that you're asking us to provide and be able to tell you how we're doing on it, both when we were successful and we fail. So that, I almost stayed within my 10 minutes. If you have questions, I've got some really reliable staff behind me that can help. If not, I can get answers back to you. And I would like to mention it is now officially day 16 for me in terms of working days.
That was going to be my question. How many days have you been here? And can you remind the committee, because we've seen you testify before, what was your most recent position before you became interim director?
My most recent position was the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency, the role that Sandy's now come in behind and provided for me.
Okay, any questions?
Yes, thank you, Chair. And on that same note, as far as interim director, is there a timeline in which they're hoping to remove the interim, whether it's you or someone else?
That's a conversation that I've had briefly with the governor. I believe that where we left it was, let's keep this agency moving forward. We can't afford a pause. So at 90 days, let's sit down and talk about what works best for Oregon and what works best for us in terms of DHS.
Okay. rescued. Any other questions? I know that one of the issues that you brought up about the licensing group that was licensed for child welfare was pretty thoroughly reviewed in Senator Gelser's committee, if you would like to look at that online, and I think there'll be some follow-up in November. So this, since they really dug into that issue, we decided to keep it broader and kind of hit all the different topics. But if you are interested in that, there's, you know, we are having continual dialogue about that. Any other questions? Well, thank you. It sounds like you really hit the ground running. And I love that you were both able to be here for the previous the presentations. Thank you for spending so much time with us, because the more that we can integrate, you know, I know it sounded like a health presentation to begin with, but so much of health is not the healthcare delivery of those that are already sick, but how do we all work together to provide a comprehensive, supportive environment and social determinants of health, and this is like where it's at.
And, and that generational change that we're all asking and looking for.
That's right. And I will just put in a plug also on the housing. Again, some of the other issues, you know, child care, if you think about how you want to reduce stress for families, maybe pregnant moms who have other children, you know, creating housing that has space for, that is zoned correctly space-wise for child care facilities, which both allows an economic opportunity for one of the residents, but also makes it a lot easier for low-income people who are trying to rush off, you know, so those kinds of things. I went to a conference over the summer as part of the National Caucus of State Legislators on the Green Building Council and how they're really trying to reduce, this is through the Brainerd Foundation and others, reduce use of toxic materials in building. I mean, there's so many different pieces that you could include in your scoring and weight them however, but I hope those are the kinds of things also that we look long, you know, how do we reduce toxic exposure so that we're healthy through the generations. So I had to get my plug in there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I am going to close the informational meeting. I don't think I need it. There's no, yeah. But on the Healthy Children, Healthy Communities focus, and invite now the panelists for the Oregon Lottery audit, which you all should have received, and I believe is on OLIS. Very thorough audit that just came to us through the Secretary of State with some recommendations. We're losing our vice chairs to school board meeting, but you can watch online.
Yes, we can.
Later. Thank you for coming, Gary.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the Director of Audits in the Secretary of State Audits Division. I was less than 6 pounds at birth weight, and there are days when I really miss those 5 extra IQ points I lost.
Everyone's writing their moms.
I'm going to have to make up for it with extra hard work. With me is Dale Bond, the audit manager who oversaw the audit of our lottery operations. So let me give you the quick thumbnail, then I'll go through the summary. While the Oregon Constitution prohibits casinos, enforcement in Oregon is very difficult because the term casino has not been clearly defined. As a result, the Oregon State Lottery's current rules and practices may not be detecting all of the retailers who receive most of their income from video gambling machines. We recommend in the audit that lotteries seek legislation to define casino and take several steps to improve compliance. So, but at this point, I also want to extend our appreciation to the lottery employees and the retailers we contacted for their assistance and cooperation. The state lottery offers a variety of gambling options for Oregonians, including Powerball, Keno, and its video gambling machines. These machines are the largest revenue source for the state in terms of all those lottery revenues, generating receipts of $743 million during fiscal year 2014, of which $178 million was paid in commissions to the retailers and $565 million was used for state purposes. As of December 2014, there were about 2,300 retailers operating about 12,000 machines. Excuse me. The Oregon Constitution allows gambling and the state lottery, but prohibits the operation of casinos in the state, though it does not provide a definition of a casino. In 1994, the Oregon Supreme Court concluded that, quote, voters intended to prohibit the operation of establishments whose dominant use or dominant purpose or both is for gambling. So as of the date of our audit, there have been no further definitions from the courts or the legislature to define casino, dominant use, or dominant purpose. What the lottery has done, though, is establish administrative rules to enforce the casino prohibition. Under its current rule, retailers are not casinos if their non-lottery sales are at least 50% of their total income. For retailers whose non-lottery income may be less than that 50%, the rule allows the lottery personnel to consider additional factors such as visual inspection to determine if a retailer is operating as a casino. But in practice, what we saw was that lottery is satisfied if a retailer's facility does not look like a casino and they perform no review of retailer income. So what we did was we looked at a group that lottery itself identified as higher risk, which were the limited menu retailers. And what they tended to be higher risk for was that they had more limited sales in terms of non-lottery products. Thus, there was a greater risk that they would exceed the 50% of income coming from their video gambling machines. In 2014, there were 234 of these limited menu retailers, and they operated 1,305, or about 11% of the 12,000 lottery machines in Oregon. That 11%, though, generated about 21%, or $158 million in revenue, in net receipts from those machines. We focused our procedures to look at those limited menu retailers and apply the lottery's enforcement practices, but what we found in doing that there are a number of retailers whose income did indeed exceed the 50% from the video gambling machines, and it would have gone undetected following the lottery's procedures. So what we recommend in this is that lottery management work with the Lottery Commission, with the governor, with the legislature, and other stakeholders to develop a clear and enforceable definition of a casino that aligns with the 1994 Supreme Court ruling of dominant use, dominant purpose. We also suggest that lottery should verify gross sales reports when using them to perform an income analysis. And lastly, that for those retailers that are challenged with meeting the 50% non-lottery income threshold, that lottery should evaluate whether removing a machine would enable the retailer to comply with that dominant use, dominant purpose court ruling. So that's essentially the summary of the audit. We're happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. First, I'd really like to thank you for the work. I know how hard it is to do an audit of this type. So can you just talk to us a little bit more about the definition of the casino? And I mean, I read the whole audit, I looked at the scope and methodology and everything, but for others on the committee, can you talk a little bit about the different challenges or some of the information that you came across? Because this has been an ongoing issue for quite some time, and this is not, we have Mr. Roberts here, the director of the lottery, here today, and he's, I think, well aware of this ongoing issue that the state has struggled with. And so can you talk a little bit more in depth, either of you, about that?
Sure. Chair Kenny Geyer, mm-hmm. Representative Taylor.
Just for the record, Gary was my boss for many years, so it's a little bit strange.
You look vaguely familiar.
You look vaguely
The definition has shifted over the years, and it's actually tightened up. Originally, the threshold was that the lottery income could be 66.6% of total income, but then the video threshold dropped down to 50%. So they've actually tightened the definition up. But in terms of the enforcement, it still becomes difficult. There isn't comprehensive gathering of total revenues. Lottery has a very clear sense of what revenues come from the machine, but not the non-lottery revenues. So they depend upon their field staff to go out and basically look at the books, look at the facilities over time, and see that they're in compliance. So they basically have operated on a series of rules over time, and they try to come up with mechanisms for ensuring that the operators understand where the lines are, and also to ensure that they're staying on the right side of those lines. But it's, I think, been a challenge for them in order to be able to enforce something that really doesn't have a clear definition. And there's some question about how they would define what those non-lottery incomes are. And they've gone through a number of rule changes over the years. And as a result, their enforcement practices have also changed.
Okay, and Chair, can I follow up? So the second recommendation here is verify gross sales reports when using them to perform the income analysis. Can you talk a little bit more about what you found when you were in the field about how the reporting currently occurs? I mean, I'm trying to understand to get the safeguards in place and all the checks and balances, how much of a lift would it be for the lottery to be able to confirm what the gross sales are? Is this going to be a great deal of work for them? Are there simple things with technology they could do, or what's involved? Because obviously there's no problem tracking the amount of money that's coming into the machines. And so I'm trying to understand how hard it would be to track the other sorts of income.
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Taylor, I can start, but Ms. Bond can also add in. We selected a sample and asked for, you know, that we would come out and look at their records. Sometimes it was a shoebox of receipts, and it could take us a number of days to go through to confirm the non-lottery income. And it would be a considerable amount of work to actually go out and be able to confirm that without having a starting number. So to the degree that we're asking retailers to distinguish, you know, that income and prepare records that could be looked at by staff, I think would add extra work. But to the degree that it's a basis for judging whether it's a casino or not, it may be something that the state should consider. Because from our perspective, we saw some retailers that were giving away beverages but counting those as sales. And there were other kinds of practices that when we corrected their books for that, we found that, in fact, they had dropped below that 50% threshold. So there needed to be some clarification of what should be counted in as far as non-lottery sales.
Okay. And then one last question. Thank you, Chair Kennegeier, is that so this concept of dropping a machine, which is an interesting concept, and I can see mathematically how that would work out. Because you also talk about in the audit, it says that you have, it says here that there are the large number that fall within a small number of the retailers. So what is, maybe one of you can remind me of which ones have the majority, something like 70% of the lottery machines are owned by a small percentage of the limited daily. You know what I mean? There's a small ownership. There's a very few number of people who own most of the limited delis. Is that correct? And then, so is it that you would drop the machine? Which ones need to drop the machine in order to have it equal out, is what I'm trying to understand.
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Taylor, what we envisioned was if there was a particular retailer that was exceeding the 50% threshold with lottery commission income, that reducing that retailer by a machine might bring that down to be within the threshold.
So I was just wondering what that would do to the lottery revenue.
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Taylor, we don't know exactly.
Okay.
The question would be, are they going to have five busier machines, or is the person going to go somewhere else to gamble, or are they going to stop gambling? That's a question where we don't know, unless we actually try something like that, whether it would produce any kind of a solution in terms of staying within the threshold.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Did you look? I only read the summary, the first three pages, but did you look at all at what the commission rates were and over time and how that's impacted use? I mean, the obvious thing that always comes up is charge a higher commission to the retailers so we get more money. And maybe if it's high enough, it'll discourage some of them from going into the business, and it'll at least give us more money for prevention and other kinds of activities. So,
Chair Kenny-Geyer, the average for all the 12,000 machines out there is about $26,000 in commission for the retailer per year. That is based upon, there's a couple of options in terms of the funding formula. We haven't, I don't know if we've got the historical, we've got some data in here. We haven't looked at particular commissions over time, but there, just because of the economy, there's been some ups and downs in recent years over the total net receipts. So it's slowly recovering from the recession. But
that's 26,000 average per retailer or per machine?
Per machine. So that was one of the ways that we tried to look at these limited menu retailers, was that if they have six machines, they would be earning about $156,000 a year if they represent the average commissions for all machines. So to that degree, that could be a challenge if they're not able to sell enough hamburgers or burritos or whatever's on their menu that would exceed that amount for the year.
And how easy is that to track to make sure that they're providing the percent that they need to, the commission that they need to? Is there a lot of fraud in that? Is that easy to audit? What do you find when, if there is an audit of it?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, it's all pretty well, they can monitor it from lottery headquarters in terms of the...
For each machine is plugged in somehow to lottery headquarters.
Correct.
And it's not an easy system to rig in some way?
I will defer in terms of any testing that we've done on a regular basis, so...
Yeah. Committee, my name is Dale Bond. I'm an audit manager at Audits Division. Chair Kenny-Geyer, system that operates the lottery's machines is audited annually by a CPA firm, Moss Adams, and they actually look at the controls that are in place to make sure that all of the electronic and computer operations are running according to management's objectives, and they also look at security over those systems. And they generally have a clean opinion of that system every year.
Okay, that's great. This is a really hard area because you can try to reduce the number of machines. That's not necessarily going to reduce the gambling. And if you say, okay, we're going to only allow this number of machines per square foot in a building or per owner. There's so many ways to get around that. You build a warehouse out back. You subcontract to your sister or brother, it's so you can see how easy it is to try to get around it when people want to provide machines and when people want to gamble. And so I keep wondering, how can we get at this in another way? Like a tobacco tax, can you raise the commission so that we are able to get more money for prevention and all that, and discourage people from maybe wanting to go into the business as much. Some people still will. Can you put the controls on it that allow the slowing down of machines? I mean, what are the other ways that we can do it other than trying to get at the supplemental sales of something else? I understand the report. I understand you're trying to get at it. But I'm not sure that it's, even if we were really good at getting them to say how many hamburgers and everything else, I'm not sure that that's going to get at the question here. So it's excellent work. It's food for thought. I think we need to continue looking at it. Certainly that's one of the things that we could try to tighten up, but I'm wondering where that really leads us, even if we tighten that up.
Can I just comment on that?
Yes.
Please? I'm so sorry. Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. I think what the intent, I mean, they can talk to, but the intention is that we've, for a very long time, and actually Representative Parrish is aware of this as well, is that there has been a longstanding issue of not being able to verify what the income is for establishments. Mm-hmm. And at less sophisticated places, for lack of a better term, it seems we had a hunch that this was more prevalent. And so without that information, it's hard to know who the good and bad operators, if you will, are. Mm-hmm. And so by the idea, I think, is to be able to say, okay, this establishment is following the rules, is meeting what the state law is, and saying that, because we do have a law, and it's not, and I guess the concern is the risk is that it's not being enforced. And so we have then by definition, by default, because doesn't seem to be at least enough enforcement, if you will, or thorough enforcement, that some then by definition are operating as a casino, because more than 50% is coming from the activity on the machines, and therefore they are in violation. So I think the concern is that perhaps we've been turning a little bit of a looking away, because this is income for the state, and what folks like me and others are primarily concerned about, it's not that I and others aren't necessarily concerned about gambling, period. It's about problem gambling, and that when you're kind of trying to get people through the door to participate, who are you attracting? And I don't think that the intention of the lottery, the actual agency, is to try to get people, addicted. They have a lot of pressure on them to produce revenue. And so because they have all this pressure on them to bring in, you need players in order to do it. But it's trying to find that balance so that we have legitimate casinos, casinos that we have legitimate lottery retailers that they're outdoing, but they're following the state law because the public has said we don't want to have casinos. But we have some where maybe they didn't wake up with the intention of doing that, but by default, they're really on the verge or are possibly operating. If you really went in and looked at everything and audited all the books, they would be in violation of that. But if we become serious about this and look at it and enforce it, then we are at risk of having less revenue for the state. And so that's what I really appreciate about the audit, is looking at really just the facts. And so
I get that, and I get that we by law don't want casinos, and it wasn't the legislature or the courts that have defined that. It was administrative rule that said that the whole dominance, dominant use, dominant purpose, is not defined by the legislature or the courts. It's defined by administrative rule as being no more than 50% of revenue, or the big qualitative, if it doesn't look like a casino. So that's very subjective. Mm-hmm. So I get that. But I'm still trying to get beyond that, which we asked you to audit, and we get back a very clear indication that it's very loose. But because the legislature hasn't done it, it's left it to the Lottery Commission, and because the Lottery Commission both has found it hard to enforce, and I get how it would be hard to count up all those receipts, and has left it to a very subjective, like what one person might think looks like a casino may not be another person. So I think that your audit has done exactly what we asked you. I think I'm just trying to ask a deeper question about, so if someone was in there selling, 60% of their stuff was hamburgers and all that, and you have a lot of gambling, is that really making any difference at all in the problem gambling? And does it make any difference at all in the commissions that are coming in as a result of that? It doesn't seem to answer it for me. I'm trying to picture a good. It's because we didn't want casinos, and there's probably tribal considerations and political considerations that also go into that. But the reality is, if we're concerned about problem gambling, is having something that sells 55% hamburgers and beer and other kinds of things like that really doing anything just to stop problem gambling? I'm not so sure that our underlying assumption is even right. We could try to tighten this up all we want, and I'm wondering how much of a difference it would really make. So I'm doing this as discussion, not like I have the answer. I'm doing this as pure, like, And it would be great, I think, for Jack Roberts to come up and give some of his perspective, since he's so kind to come and listen to the hearing. So
I guess, you know, my thought is Kathleen and myself and Kinnamer and, you know, Carolyn and you,
right.
You know, but we put a lot of time into this.
Yeah.
I actually think at some point we've put forward what could be the best policy solutions to sort of start to wean ourselves off, make more investments into mm-hmm. problem gambling. We know we want to do that. I think we've discussed over the years, you know, real, like, sort of gross profits of the lottery in a different formula that says minus societal costs equals, you know, true net divided out by percentages that voters have voted on would be the true funding formula of the lottery, rather than backfilling general fund into prisons and social services caused by the 86,000 problem gamblers and all of, you know, the drama that goes with their lives when they're in that form of addiction. The reality is this body doesn't have the will. I mean, that's, we've seen it. We've tried to move those bills, and so we can ask them to audit till forever, and it still doesn't get us out of, you know, commiserate with the public good, and them trying to balance that. We've given them, I think, very clear direction on, you know, please balance that and get the ads back up on TV, and they've done those things, and I really think it's going to have to be us. And I'm, you know, just as guilty. I'd like lottery dollars for veterans because I can lock it into the Constitution and make sure we're going to care for them, and I'm going to keep pushing for that. But, and I'm not anti-gambling. I am pro-supporting problem gambler, and there's a difference there. But, you know, we certainly know that people will find a place to gamble. We're seeing it in these poker rooms in Portland. You know, Labor Commissioner came in a few months ago and ruled on some wage and hour problems that are happening there because they're out of compliance. So we're sort of out of compliance all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could work group this to death, but unless the presiding officers are going to empower legislation to move through your committee or somebody's committee, I just don't see how we get there. Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating because, you know, my sister was addicted to video poker and steal your wallet to go do it. And that turns into a, you know, a justice problem. And we hear these stories in our community. You know, we've seen, we can rehash every time all of us meet. We all know those stories. And I don't know how to get the other, you know, 80 some odd of us to wrap their heads around that, because, you know, they're down there trying to figure out how to spend it all too at the same time. So it's frustrating.
So I agree. And I was on that committee.
Yes,
for 4 years
were.
Too. And so I tried to, like, in my mind as a committee chair, think about, okay, so if we take these recommendations to ensure that our practice is in alignment with what the legislature, our legislation says, which is that we don't want, this is exactly what you did, and here's what you have to do to align the practice with what our legislation calls for in not having casinos in Oregon, where does that really lead us in terms of, does this help problem gambling at all? I am not convinced that while you laid out a clear direction, I'm not actually convinced that our original... I'm just not convinced that it... So I think that a way to get at that, trying to help reduce addictions, there are some technological things out there with slowing down machines, but also if we had more money in it for mental health and addictions, and if it could come out of the retailers' pockets, frankly, that seems to be like a place. So we would be gathering... And the whole thing about there's no appetite for lowering revenue, it could increase revenue, but then we put it into places that could help the problem gamblers, not the recreational gamblers. So anyway, I've been part of work groups and listening to this and reading things and struggling with what I don't want to do wasted time and spinning our wheels.
Just wanted to comment. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I don't know that like you said, I mean, the objective wasn't about how to deal with problem gambling. And if we had some of the problem gambling experts in the room, they could talk about what would help and not help with folks who are addicted to gambling. I think this is helpful, though, because we've forever struggled with some of the things that are around that and some of the what are the kind of the unofficial, and desperate is too strong of a word, but some of the things that may be happening out there to kind of keep gambling going at the retail level, giving free sodas and food and keeping people when they're sitting for a long period of time, just little things that I have at least heard some of the experts and counselors say it would help a little bit. It's like giving an alcoholic a free drink at the bar. It's like not really helping that. And then also we as a state would never, ever, ever promote drink more and smoke more because that brings in money for the state. Mm-hmm. We would never promote that. Mm-hmm. But we don't tell OLCC, we don't put the pressure on OLCC. And in fact, with smoking, we go the other way. We're trying to reduce smoking by raising costs
right.
and in criminalizing so that if you sell to minors and things like that.
Right.
Mr. Roberts and I have had many conversations about the lottery over the years. He does not have people telling him to reduce. He has, and I want to appreciate the enormous amount of pressure that he has put on him individually and for the whole agency to bring some money in. Mm-hmm. So we are sending a mixed message.
Absolutely.
And I do think that this audit is very, very helpful because people talk about all these kind of little, maybe perceived as smaller things, but it makes it concrete. And this is only the stuff that can be proven. So the audits division would have a very difficult time saying exactly this act would promote problem gambling or something. That's a pretty hard thing to say concretely in an audit. I mean, that would be a pretty tough lift because the standards are so high for audits. You have to be able to prove every single one of these sentences. Mm-hmm. So that would be a challenge. But I think it's helpful to have this be an area so that we can having this defined, worked through, proven, and make it so that we can continue to have conversations with the lottery and with Mr. Roberts about how to best manage this going forward. But you are right in theory. This is not addressing problem gambling. You are right in theory. It's identifying some things that some of the problem gambling experts have said contribute to it. Mm-hmm. Proximity, giving free beverages and food, some of the other things. So with that being said,
Mr. Roberts, we'd love to have your thoughts.
Thank you. My name, for the record, Jack Roberts, the director of the Oregon Lottery. And it's actually been fascinating listening to this because it's exactly the thing that we deal with all the time in terms of balancing a lot of different public policy issues and our responsibilities under the Constitution and the statutes. A couple things I would say, just generally. First of all, I think that the Secretary of State's office did a great job of coming in, looking at this, and getting a handle on the issues. And we really... which we're fortunate we have a long-time relationship with the Secretary of State because they audit our books every year. And that's an alternative to having to come to Ways and Means. And having been head of BOLI for 8 years, I would much rather have the Secretary of State's audit every year than go to Ways and Means. Not that it's not a wonderful group of people, but it's just a different environment. But in looking at their audit, I think they raised the right question, which is, what is the casino prohibition all about? And we have to start by reminding ourselves this was a citizen-backed initiative that was passed in 1984 to raise money for the state. That's what it was all about. And I remember very well, because I voted against it, because I thought the state needed comprehensive tax reform. And 30 years later, we still do.
Step back.
Oh, sorry. So I think it was a decision the voters made for a revenue basis. The very next year, the voters voted down with their regular 25% yes vote a sales tax, which I did vote for. And so ever since then, we've been seeing the same thing. We vote for limitations on property taxes. We don't necessarily vote for alternative revenues, although we did in 1995, we voted to extend the usage of lottery funds from just being economic development to include education. That was after Measure 5 had been passed. Voters again defeated a sales tax, but said, yes, we'd like you to use lottery money. That's also right after we decided to go to the line games, or excuse me, the video poker initially, and increasing the revenue. So this isn't something that just happened by accident. It really is being pushed by a demand for services by the state and an unwillingness to pay for it in other ways. Mm-hmm. So that is an issue that we have to deal with. The question, I think, the one that we really can't answer at this point, but I think we need to address as a state, is why do we have a casino prohibition? And, again, remembering those times, at that time, casinos in the United States were only in Nevada and in Atlantic City. and we all had a pretty good idea of what those were. Those were the big buildings with all kinds of variety of games and things that they made. They made a huge impact on those communities, and that's what Oregonians didn't want. Today we actually have casinos on tribal land because federal law allows that, so people have a chance to see the difference. I would argue that from the standpoint of casino prohibition, you could very well say that our statutory limitation of no more than six machines per retailer prevents them from being casinos as we normally think of that term. I would just say it was a kind of a thought experiment. If you blindfolded a couple of people and took one of them to one of our tribal casinos and one of them to a deli and took the blindfold off and said, are you a casino or are you not? The answer would be pretty clear. I also don't think that casino prohibition per se was designed to deal with problem gambling because, frankly, in 1984, I don't think we had the information and the data that we have today about problem gambling, and that wasn't what voters were thinking about. And I'm still not convinced that there is really data that says that the deli model is creating more problem gamblers than others. Now, to the extent that they're doing a higher volume of business, then presumably it'll be a larger number of problem gamblers there. But as a percentage basis, I'm just not aware of any data that says that's what's causing it. We have worked really hard since I've been here to develop a good relationship with the problem gambling community and try to deal with that because we do think we have a responsibility. I'm not sure the casino prohibition is the best way to do it. And finally, what I would also say, when the Secretary of State's office did their audit, as we explained to them, we were in the process of changing our focus from looking at all retailers to concentrating on those limited menu retailers, which are really what we often refer to as delis, because we felt that's where the real problem lies. And so consequently, since that time, we have been doing a full on-site investigation of all of those. And we were just in the process of starting that when they started their audit. And so they found some. And the main ones they found, incidentally, that were under-reporting their non- or they were actually over-reporting their non-lottery sales, so the percentage looked better, were ones that were giving comp items to their employees or to players and were counting that as sales, which was clearly against our rules. In fact, back more than a decade ago, we prosecuted, well, prosecutor's the wrong word, we were taking the contract away from one of the delis for that. That was appealed, we lost at the circuit court, one of the court of appeals, and our rules were upheld. And we do have the power to do that. But in these cases, the ones you were looking at, most of them, in our view, would not have really flunked the other test of looking at, does this look like a casino? And what I would suggest to you is that if we agreed at some point that these aren't really casinos, if you are limited to six machines, they're not really casinos, we could change our rules and have rules that say, but what is consistent with our mission to raise revenue commensurate with the public good, and that it's not public good to have operations that are just exclusively selling lottery, and that we need to have other things that are going on there that can sort of provide other uses for their time and money. And I think the money focus, which was actually never part of the Supreme Court decision, they talked about dominant use, dominant purpose. They never talked about revenue. That was something we invented at the lottery. I think there are ways that we can deal with it. So I think the discussion is an important one to have. We ought to think about that really in terms of what is consistent with our values as a state. I don't think that we should expect that that by itself is going to have a significant impact on problem gambling. That's a battle we're going to have to continue to fight in all of our locations. And in fact, one of the things we hear about the so-called delis, the limited menu restaurants, is that they are particularly attractive to women who don't like going into bars and taverns, and I can understand that, and they are generally regarded as places that are brighter, cleaner, better places to go. That's an important thing in terms of broader customer service, but the question that we have to deal with. What are we going to do about trying to address the problem gambling issue is one that we probably have other tools that will better deal with that than going in and spending a lot of our time auditing these individual places to make sure they're selling enough food and alcohol to balance off their lottery revenue.
Mm-hmm. Representative Parrish?
Thanks. So you just touched on something that I actually think is a problem. the lottery, to get a lottery license, you have to hitch your wagon to the OLCC. The OLCC gives you an alcohol license as long as you were selling five, you know, minimal items of food, you know, and having taught those OLCC classes, I can tell you, and gone into a lot of bars and restaurants and done, offered that training to servers, five, you know, distinctly different items, you know, certainly doesn't mean that you sell a ham sandwich and a turkey sandwich, and yet what I'm seeing these days, in more so than, you know, 15 years ago, 12, 13 years ago, whenever it was that I was teaching those classes, what I've seen qualify as minimum items of food is, you know, almost non-existent at this point, and I'm not seeing that enforcement on the OLCC part, but because we necessarily, because we require lottery license to be hitched to alcohol, and therefore, you know, to have that quality standard, if you will, be so diminished, you know, those delis don't sell a ton of alcohol. We could make the argument that, you know, having lottery in a place where alcohol is being sold, but I don't see a ton of women going in there and drinking, certainly not to excess, and like you would think about going into a bar or a casino where somebody's bringing you rounds of drinks, is problematic. And I would argue that if your wagon either statutorily or constitutionally needs to be hitched to the OLCC, that you could, as lottery commission, create a higher standard for what needs to be served in order to have a lottery license. And regardless of what the liquor commission is doing for having an alcohol permit, because when you walk into one of those places, and we've all gone and looked at them at some point or another, there's almost no other, but for their lottery proceeds, could they maintain a triple net lease? And the answer is no. So I think you, as us, as a, you know, policy directive, could actually create a higher standard of what you have to be serving in a, you know, in a lottery establishment where alcohol is being served, to create that threshold. And there be some people who just flat out don't want to do it. But I'm not opposed to having a higher standard that does not align with the Liquor Commission's five minimal food items.
And we've actually been doing that lately. We have actually been going in and telling people you need to have something more than a microwave oven and frozen burritos. And in fact, some retailers that I had visited when I first got here, I went back a few months ago and saw that they have fryers, they have other things in there to try to do that. Now, I think that's important for us, for our brand and for what we're trying to do. Again, I don't think that really affects whether it's a casino or not a casino.
No, I know.
And I'm not entirely sure that the fact that they sell more in lottery, or their revenue from lottery is higher than what they make on the others, should really be the test. But it's, are you offering those things? Are you making that available? Is this a place that people look at and they say that they have lottery but they have other things? And some of our highest volume restaurants are actually retailers or restaurants that have other things too. So there is, it's an interesting mix when you look at it. But from the deli side of it, I think that you're right. We do need to step up and do more than what the minimum OLCC requirement is, and I think that's part of the responsibility we're willing to accept.
Okay, a follow up. So on the dominant use piece, and I agree, it's hard to sort of tether that to sales, because if you only sell a certain amount of sandwiches versus somebody plugging $20 bills into a lottery machine, difficult to get to, which is why I sort of keep going back to the but for. Would your business exist without that revenue? That, to me, makes it dominant use. If you're not, couldn't stand alone in business without that piece of revenue being ancillary to your business, could you exist? It does not necessarily speak to a direct X amount of dollars, but purpose of being in business. So it's clear to me personally that if you are, you know, took those machines out, would half of those delis fold when they only give you a bag of peanuts and Hot Pockets? You're not going to make triple net lease selling Hot Pockets in a microwave. And that's really what we have based on how we've structured this. And so I don't think that necessarily speaks to sales, but I do think it speaks to, are you a viable business model but for lottery? And we should, you know, put some emphasis on that, with maybe without a specific dollar amount or machine amount or any of those kind of things.
I appreciate that. Like, often this is when you get to be a certain age, you get to tell anecdotes about the old days. And when I was labor commissioner, one of the issues that was before the legislature was, as we were raising our minimum wage above the national average, should we allow tip credits, as they do in many states? And I remember attending a lot of those hearings, and retailers would come in, people who owned restaurants, and they were making a plea for how tough it is and how they're doing that. And one of the legislators, by the name of Dan Gardner, who later replaced me as labor commissioner, consistently asked them, do you have video poker? In those days, that's all we had was video poker. We didn't have the other games. And invariably, they'd say yes. Say, well, then, shouldn't you be making enough money in that to be able to pay the higher minimum wage? And they didn't have a good answer for that. And so you could say that there are a lot of businesses that maybe didn't need to have these lottery machines in 1991 when we went in that direction. But they've grown in that direction, not only because of their financial needs, but because we set higher standards for food servers and what their compensation is than most other states. And I think that's great. I think it's good that we do that, and we may be raising it higher. But to turn around and say, well, but if you can't do your business without having that, then you ought to shut the door, because then all those employees are going to have a 0 hours at a higher minimum wage, and that doesn't translate into paying the bills at home for them either.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. I mean, I agree with what Representative Parrish said, and it is not a lot that there. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I know the lottery does. And it's been shown to me in the past. There's a certain number of the retailers that have been established. It's increasing over time, and the geographical location of where they're starting, where they've been placed, they wouldn't most likely be able to exist on their own without lottery. So that does meet the definition of that they're operating as a mini casino. And I think the frustrating part where the tension is that we don't have it defined. And because we don't have it defined, when you gave the example of the blindfold, well, we can't be making state policy on that type of, I think it's time to make a definition, because so that we can all have the same playing field, so that you can do your job according to the rules and by the law, and we then can enforce it. I mean, that is how what we do. We do this with OLCC. We do this with a whole host of agencies. There's the policies, and we make certain that they're enforced. And I think that what this has done is identified some areas where we have need room for improvement. Regarding Jack and I don't know if we call it agreed to disagree or whatever the phrase is, but we've talked a lot about the cause and effect of problem gambling. And if we had some of the experts here today, then I think they could shed light on what does drive someone to be addicted. And there's a variety of components, not that they're necessarily covered in this audit, but there are some, there is some research, and there are some things that there are other causations if you're born with a certain addictive tendencies and et cetera, but there are things such as speed of machine and et cetera. So it's not as if there's nothing that can be stated about what drives what contributes to a person being a problem gambler. However, making the reference about women, I believe that we've had people come in, at least if they haven't testified, they've said in our work groups that the fastest growing population of people who are problem gamblers are middle-aged women, that they're the fastest growing of the people who are problem gamblers. My understanding is, but I can't be quoted because I don't have exact numbers in front of me, are middle-aged women. And the casinos that are the limited delis that are opening up in the shopping malls and et cetera that are safe and light and bright and it's not a bar environment, that by itself is creating a welcoming environment for people. Now, that's a tough public policy issue, as we all know, because some people, not every single person that goes in there has an addiction problem. Some are just doing it because it's fun, but some are contributing to it. So we can go on and on and on, as Representative Parrish said, and Mr. Roberts and I have gone back and forth on this subject, and we've had the work groups and et cetera. But I really appreciate what the audit had, the light that's been shined on the areas that they were able to prove, which again, this is they have to go on facts here. And we have another layer here that has been a multi-year issue that we're working on. And I do agree with you, it's not necessarily going to take care of the problem gambling, but it's kind of chipping away and helping to identify what we can do. But until the state is prepared to really examine what we're going to be doing about revenue, it will continue to be a struggle. So,
and it may be, I mean, this particular tact at approaching it may actually be getting more at neighborhood livability issues than problem gambling. So I think there's the sensibility about that issue, like on Hayden Island, where you have row after row after row, and a lot of the neighborhood is not happy about it.
No.
And so, it's not just about problem gambling. It's about livability. I can see where this gets more at that but I think just requiring a higher percentage to be of hamburgers and things to be sold may get somewhat at the neighborhood livability. I don't know that it gets at the usage at all of the game. And so I was kind of, I was starting on that, like, this is a big political uphill battle, and I'm not sure it's going to really make a difference other than the neighborhood livability issue.
And accessibility for those who are addicted.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I mean, I think about addictive personalities and natures and where you can gamble, and not just, you know, in our Oregon Lottery, but, you know, these poker rooms, somebody's, you know, living room, you know, people who are, you know, sort of now this fantasy sports online and have multiple teams and a hope to win something. I mean, it's like, at the end of the day, even if you've lifted up the Oregon Lottery, will we have, you know, problem gamblers? You know, you bet. I don't know that. I think you're right. I think it is, you know, do we want seven of them sighted on in one, you know, strip mall or whatever within a two-block radius of each other? It's almost like the certificate of need conversation we have in healthcare. Like, do you really need another surgical center in Bend?
Right.
Right?
And we now have rules that prohibit that.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I mean, so I think that the Lottery Commission is doing the things that they can do to the extent that it's within the Constitution and statute. I mean, I think it's the onus is really going to be on the legislature to make, you know, some kind of big decision about, you know, we've had the concept of do you cap the growth and put at the lottery and put the rest in a rainy day fund to sort of wean us off of that, and or, you know, or how else do you use those dollars? And I almost don't know, though, that you can do much more than what you can do in the current construct of the Constitution and the statutes as they're written. Until we're ready to actually make a policy decision that either, A, we can do statutorily, or, B, have to refer out to the voters for a decision, since it is the Constitution and they do get to have some measure of say depending on what action we take, I almost think we're stuck. I feel like we're in a holding pattern, and there's, you know, you've put more ads on TV, you're, you know, trying to negate where some of these folks go. We can ask you to serve 50 food items. I mean, I still think there is a relationship of, did I go to the deli because I wanted to gamble, or did I go to the deli because I wanted a sandwich? When I go to Spirit Mountain, it's because I'm going to, you know that I'm going to put some money on the craps table and walk away maybe empty-handed, but I didn't spend the mortgage either. And so is it a destination for that purpose? Or is it because, you know, you're looking for the food, or, you know, Wayne Newton who comes out or something, right? I mean, like, is there some other reason to go? And if the answer is they're going because it's a destination to gamble, then it doesn't matter if that's a bingo hall or a casino or whatever. People are going to lay their money down and throw the dice and hope that, you know.
It also doesn't matter whether there's 14 varieties of hamburgers and garden burgers.
That's right. I mean, and if the feds lift the, you know, there's conversation at the congressional level of, you know, should we put online poker back on or whatever, like, you know, or online whatever, gambling. I mean, if that comes back online, then it won't matter if the, you know, Liquor Commission's doing it. It'll just be people who want to engage in that activity will find a way to throw money down on something and bet and lose it. You know, to the extent that, are there any other safeguard things that you think we could be doing, or that, you know, we need some direction on, you know, whether it's the speed of the machines or any of those things? I'm in favor of putting card readers in there, and, you know, you start to see a significant usage on someone's card. You're mailing them something that says, you know, hey, thank you for spending your money with the state of Oregon. Can we interest you in treatment? You know, like, I mean, I think that we're almost at our rope of what we can actually do without giving you clear policy from this body. I just don't know that there's more.
Any other comments? Any other closing thoughts from the audit division?
No.
No.
You've been. Thanks for the work.
Yes, exactly. I wanted to give you a chance after all the work that you did on this. Thank you so much for helping illuminate our discrepancy from legislative intent.
May I say one final thing? I think, thank you, Chair Kennegar. Mr. Roberts, the next time that we ask you to come here, I think it would be beneficial is for folks to really see how many bills end up getting passed since 94, how many bills we end up passing asking for lottery-backed, you know, to be paid for by lottery bonds. Uh-huh. So really showing to, you know, in all fairness, because you can... I mean, Mr. Roberts is a big boy, and so when I talk with him, he can take it. But, you know, it's that there is serious pressure,
serious pressure and to generate revenue. And I think that if we put it in putting it in context of how many bills were passed and say, oh, that's a lottery backed bond to pay for things, then and all these things that
it's a pretty good point, because that's bond out 10 to 15 years. So
exactly, that's not, the other point.
It isn't just that you want
exactly.
to spend all the money, which I sympathize with the crunch you guys are in trying to balance the budget each biennium, and then trying to maintain that through the biennium, and having something like the kicker that no one really anticipated suddenly kicks, and you have to get, I understand all that. But it's one thing to say we need the money now. It's another thing to say, and oh, by the way, we've already spent it out 15 that's years. Now we'd like you to find some way to do it with make less money with fewer players, or make more money and find some way to do it. It's not easy. So I'm glad you understand that.
And that's you just brought up a really good point. I've had this conversation with Ted Wheeler. You know, there's a flaw in the Constitution about bonding with lottery dollars, and or statute, or somewhere there's a flaw that basically says that if we are bonding, that the bonds get paid back first. That's not how this is done. So every time we're sending out, hey, we'll bond against the lottery, we'll bond against the lottery, at some point, if we really bumped up against that ceiling, or lottery revenues, you know, dip like they did for, you know, any reason, economic, or we make some other policy decision, you know, now it's about marijuana and, you know, playing the lottery. I'm sure that's the next conversation. But that there is a flaw in how we bond, and that you know, with the lottery, and that the bond dollars don't have to be paid back first as a priority. And that is a problem when we are leveraging lottery dollars to bond heavily. And I would be absolutely in favor of a public policy that says we are no longer going to bond for lottery dollars. That's, you know, really cash payment up front, limit ourselves to get out of the, you know, the bonding business of using bond dollars, lottery bond dollars. I think that that is a really important ways and means conversation that we should be having, because at some point, if there was ever a dip, who's on the hook for the bonds if the dollars aren't there? And yet we are really putting out 10, 15, 20, 30 years of bonds into the future. It's a problem.
And I understand exactly the issue that you're raising. I think it's always good to kind of have a conversation about that. A couple of things to keep in mind. One, the way we bond is that we will have $3 backing it for every dollar that we bond. And so that puts some cushion in there if things go bad. The other thing I would say is that one of the reasons we keep using it is that we have the highest rated lottery bonds of any state in the country. We're slightly ahead of Florida and West Virginia, and the others are farther behind. So it has been a very successful vehicle, and it's being used, I think, responsibly by not by putting a cap on how much we can bond and trying to make sure we have more than enough coverage. And so while I think those discussions are always worthwhile, I think they've been as responsible as they can be in terms of using that as a resource and enabling us to maximize the use of those resources for many good, worthwhile programs. And they can only be bonded for programs that otherwise fall within the constitutional mission, which is economic development, which is a broad area, but also schools and our parks and watersheds. So
it's only, Jack, that's only as good as the legislators who are running the Ways and Means process, right? I mean, at some point, you could
get somebody. How can that possibly go wrong?
You know, you have, right now, I mean, Senator Devlin is a pretty good, like, push on folks, all of us, about, you know, capacity. But, you know, there could come a time when our Ways and Means co-chairs are somebody else, besides Buckley and Devlin and Richardson when he was here, that suddenly changes that matrix that you just talked about, which could make us insolvent or, you know,
I understand the concern. I would say, having been around here for quite a while, we've had a pretty good run of people at Ways and Means. I think that you and your colleagues do a very good job of choosing who should be heading that up through your leadership.
We could be losing both of them this year, so I think.
Well,
I
want to note that the three diehards on the gambling addiction will let former Representative Carolyn Tomei know that we're here to the end. Thank you so much for coming. I'm going to close our hearing on Human Services and Housing Committee. Thank you.